This so-called end times doctrine of the Masons and of the British Empire has nothing to do with Christianity. That people who believe in a second coming of Christ based on the teachings of the founders of the Christian faith have a different viewpoint, and it's also part of the Jewish faith. They claim that the Messiah hasn't come yet. But the concept of a future time when mankind will have a better life based on a Messiah, based on God's grace to mankind, is the opposite, is clearly the opposite from somebody who's saying that God is going to destroy humanity, really from the standpoint that God hates mankind and thinks that mankind is not worth having. There's obviously, it's clearly a completely opposite concept.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Friday the 30th of June 2023, streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol, on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, anything please but Google. I'm Tony Gosling. Apologies for last week's little hiccup. Now, thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda, the psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators, and the hatchet jobs on the heroes. Cancelling vote winners like Boris and Trump, while Big Pharma's Matt Hancock and Bill Gates' crimes against humanity are all forgotten for the evil Putin. So anyway, this week we're joined by PCS Southwest Regional Organiser Justin Thomas, and a little bit later at 6 by ex-sociology professor David Miller, and helping us navigate us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution. Whatever that looks like, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. To begin with, we'll be looking at the cost of living crisis, which is looking at the reasons for that, the reasons why the government hasn't sorted it out. Does it want to sort it out? Who is the government really working for? Is it for the voters or somebody else? And also the idea of bankruptcy, as we've been hearing this week with Thames Water, the idea of those wonderful things that Thatcher privatised back in the 1980s just becoming unviable. In fact, building up massive, massive amounts of debt, which is unpayable. And we'll also be looking at private equity versus hedge funds with Martin Summers. In part two, the Midazolam story. Jackie Devoy talks about eugenics and her father's death with Midazolam. And we've got various other little exclusives in part two, including a look at Pride Month. So, start with you then, Justin. Can you just tell us a bit of, I mean, I know you've done a few times on here, but tell us a little bit about your job. You're a regional organiser for the PCS, Public and Commercial Services Union.
Yep, that's right, Tony. So, my main role at the moment, currently, is that I am the Group Secretary for Defence, so I deal with MOD and other agencies, one of the biggest being defence equipment and support. And ultimately, I'm protecting our members in those jobs, much as we protect our members in the civil service widely.
Do you ever get grilled about on your views about foreign office affairs and the rights and wrongs of what the Ministry of Defence are up to?
So, not by the members, and not by the employer, and not by my union. So probably a no, Tony. No,
well, only by
but feel free.
Only
know.
By me. So yeah, but also, I mean, one of the things I can remember we've been talking about for years here, and you're talking, I guess, here about Abbey Wood. Now, Abbey Wood is the Ministry of Defence procurement up at Filton. Massive offices, all obviously quite high security, but I mean, not too over the top. And what sort of proportion of that is the membership of the union in the southwest?
I mean, the short answer is not enough, and we'd always like more, but it's certainly not as high in density as we are in other areas, such as, say, DWP, for example.
Right, so density means the number of people working there who are... Yeah. So what's been going on up at Abbey Wood over the years? Because I kept hearing rumours about its privatisation. I mean, we're going back 5 years or so now, and the independent...
Yeah, maybe a bit more than that. Yeah, I mean, that was off the table, effectively, by the time I got involved. I don't think it's a possibility. I don't think it's an issue anymore.
I'm not sure of the contractor, but it was a big American defence contractor that wanted to take it over.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, there's probably 20 big contractors involved in defence in the UK, and ultimately there always have been, because not everything has been produced by the state, you know. I mean, it was a big thing after, I think it was the First World War, when there was issues around supply, that the state stepped in and took over a lot of the munitions companies and things like that, and then gradually they've sort of passed them back to the private sector. So Boeing, Sodexo, you know, Babcock, etc., they're all involved.
Martin Summers, there's a big difference, though, isn't there, between the public sector and the private sector, the kit they produce for the military to use. The public sector and the private sector have got different kind of motives, really.
Well, I think you can see that quite clearly in the technicalities of what's going on in the war in Ukraine, because, of course, the Russians have got a nationalised arms industry. They do subcontract some things, because, you know, you need to have the flexibility to subcontract some things. But, of course, it means ultimately the generals are in charge of designing the kit they want, and then they send people away to produce it. Whereas what you've got in the West, particularly in the US and Britain, is you've got these companies that are producing weaponry, but they want to produce the most sophisticated, that is to say, the most complex weaponry that costs the most money, because they're all on these cost-plus contracts, whereby, you know, whatever it costs, you can just charge more on top of that to make your profit.
So you make a contract, but then you actually change the shift the goalposts, effectively.
Yeah, well, once you've got the contract, don't forget defence industry, because of all the security implications and so on and so forth. We could have the Chinese supplying our weaponry cheaper. But, of course, potentially the enemy,
GCHQ,
that's not really a sensible thing to do.
We heard from Alex Thompson, GCHQ were actually, their internal communications devices were supplied by the Chinese. But does it matter?
Well, there's two things here. There's one is the economics of it, and the other is, you know, defence isn't like other industries, you know, because you can't just open it up to global competition. And so, therefore, the decisions about how to produce things and what to produce in what quantities are ultimately political decisions.
And what about the secrecy? Because they will say, well, we can't tell you anything about what we're doing in here.
Well, that's right, but you've got secrecy in the Russian military system as well. But, of course, since it's all run by the military, for the military, on a not-for-profit basis, what you've got in the West is a lot of overcharging, you know, the $500... toilet seat and all the rest of it. And also the kit itself is poorly designed, because it's, you know, the contractors are interested in selling stuff. So the war in Ukraine, the US military industry, Raytheon and so on, their shares have gone through the roof, because they, you know, they're being given loads of money to produce more of the stuff they've already produced.
Justin, look, I know it's totally unfair, but can I ask you about these sorts of questions? Do you ever get stories about dodgy kit being produced here in the UK?
Yeah, we do. I'm probably being a bit careful around this sort of area, Tony, if that's all right.
Well, there have been some court cases, for example, I remember about some device which was supposed to be being used to electronically scan vehicles in Afghanistan for, I don't know where
it was. In Iraq. It was supposed to be to tell with vehicles had bombs on, but of course it was just made up. It was just a made up thing, and the government bought it.
Yeah, so somehow someone is spending a fortune on something that doesn't even work, and it's not apparently even been tested. Does that surprise you?
So we certainly commissioned a report with Roger Seifert from Keele University about 4 or 5 years ago, and basically that report was looking into the interaction between the private sector with the public sector, and especially about outsourcing. That was a big thing for us, was the outsourcing. I mean, look, a lot of this sort of the military-industrial complex, they do work hand in hand together, you know, and Martin's right. You know, there's definite tensions and there's definite differences between them. But ultimately, it's very hard to sort of put a cigarette paper between their interests. You know, even in this country, we have military, you know, people who are in uniform working in these defence industries, and we have them advising on what products are going to be produced, etc.
You know what, that reminds me a bit of Thames Water and revolving doors with the regulators and this sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, certainly in discussions we do raise the issues of revolving doors. So, I mean, it's very close, you know, when people leave the military and they go into work for people, you know, like Rolls-Royce and BAE Systems and stuff like that. You know, essentially, you could look at it one way and you could say, well, that's just corrupt, that's just nepotism. On the other hand, these companies want their expertise and they want their frontline experience, you know. So it's really very, very close. It's a close relationship.
But anyway, you've got more importantly in many ways, you've got this pay dispute going on at the moment, which is a reaction to this cost of living crisis. Before we talk about that, can you just say what you think of who is responsible for the large increase in food prices, in housing prices? We've got an enormous, you know, leap in energy prices too. So where people were fairly close to having an equal amount of income and expenditure, they're now below the limit, aren't they?
My personal view is that this is a culmination of maybe the last 10-15 years. Companies just weren't able to extract enough profit from working people, especially in this country, and they're letting us have it now. I don't think it's got as much to do with the war in Ukraine. I appreciate that's going to be blamed, and I appreciate energy prices have gone up. I think it's pure opportunism on food, on energy, and anything else that these people can get away with. And part of it was possibly a kickback to COVID and not making as much money as they thought they were going to do in that period.
Well, it's amazing, wasn't it? Well, it's a funny story. It's about a year ago, Sainsbury's stopped stocking Heinz beans. And the reason they gave it was because they were coming in at something like 25-30% more than they had been the week before. It's the same beans. But this really was described at the time, Martin, I'll go to you now, as price fixing. So the idea is that, you know, we've built up this kind of almost oligopoly of supermarkets, that these are the only ways that farmers can really bulk sell their food, unless it's to a little local farm shop. The same with the big food producers, that they're in a monopoly position effectively, and that they can charge whatever they want. And so they're just saying, well, I'll tell you what, let's just turn up the prices.
Well, I mean, the phrase that's used about this is greedflation, isn't it? And in the US, it's very clear that companies know that in an inflationary environment, they can raise their prices, and they can always give the excuse, we have to do that because of the inflation, even if their costs haven't risen. So there's an opportunity there for them to gouge the public, and they take it, because we've got an increasingly oligopolistic economy, which basically means big firms who are price makers rather than price takers. We had lots and lots of small firms. If they rose their prices, people wouldn't buy the stuff. But if you're supplying things like gas, electricity, stuff like this, in Norway, for example, they've got a state-owned oil industry, and of course the price of oil and gas has gone through the roof, but that money they've got speculators as well based on the National Wealth Fund, and they've made a huge killing in this crisis in Norway, not least because it looks as if the Norwegians may have been involved in the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline with the Americans, at least according to Seymour Hersh. But of course that money goes to the national government. And the national government can then say, right, we're gonna cut the bills for all pensioners, whatever. What we've got in this country, because it's privately owned, is all of that surplus profit, which comes from the situation, goes into the pockets of the private shareholders.
How is it? How has something funny happened with Thames Water that they've now got? Is it something like 40 something billion pounds worth of debt? Never mind, lots of extra money going to the shareholders. They're now they've plunged the company into so much debt that it's no longer viable, apparently. And one of the stories this week spotted was from Arj Singh in The Eye, the revolving door of staff between water firms and regulators clamping down on sewage stinks, it says. There is a revolving door of executives between regulators supposed to clamp down on sewage spills and water companies, raising questions about a conflict of interest. An investigation has revealed at least six senior current industry staff members have been identified as moving jobs between regulators, including Ofwat and the Environment Agency, and water firms such as Southern, Northumbrian and Southwest Water. It's triggered warnings that regulators could feel sympathetic to their mates at the former company or water company executives who know how to avoid regulations. Isn't that quite clever? So they were sitting at the regulator going, well, we could, you know, this is the way all the regular fine print of the regulations. And then they suddenly get recruited by a water company to help them get round those regulations. So calls also for the anti-corruption watchdog, ACOBA, the Advisory Committee on Business Appointments, to investigate this, which seems an almost useless organisation. This Advisory Committee on Business ACOBA, which we keep hearing about, actually, this whole week. We've been hearing about all sorts of things to do with this organisation, this little quango, I'll get whatever it is. The investigation by the Lib Dems found that despite the movements between such organisations, numerous Freedom of Information requests and parliamentary questions submitted by the party indicated the government holds no data on how many former water company employees work for industry regulators. Well, we just heard as well, didn't we, today, Sue Gray, the woman in charge of the investigation into Partygate, is going to be serving Keir Starmer in his role. What do you make of these sorts of things where you've got someone very political involved? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do have thoughts on that, because effectively what we get told by the civil service en masse is that they need this expertise and they want these people coming in from industry. So in some respects, it's no different from what you've seen in Thames Water with Ofwat, etc., and the Environment Agency, and obviously a lot of the Environment Agency is civil service anyway, and what you get in Defence and what you get in the General Civil Service. What we're told is they want this expertise, they want this revolving door, they want people coming in with industry experience, improving things, and then they want them going back and taking that experience of the civil service back into industry, you know, because they tell us they want both sides understanding what they do. There's obviously tensions there, there's conflicts there, but there's also advantages. It's very, very hard to draw a line on that one.
Yeah, so hang on, what advantages are there to having someone from one of these big organisations like Thames Water that's just gone apparently virtually bankrupt? We're not quite sure exactly what is it. I don't know if you can have to say into liquidation. I'm not sure. Is that just too cheesy?
Yeah, but
you know, someone from there suddenly becoming a regulator. I mean, they're supposed to be in opposition to each other, but it seems that they're actually very, very, well, far too pally, Justin.
Yeah, well, I mean, and all they'll do is they'll say, well, we need to understand what the industry's needs and demands are. You know, that's the kind of thing that they'll tell us. You know, it's probably a little bit more clear-cut.
Didn't there used to be in the old days? Now, this is, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but a different culture, a kind of public sector culture and a private sector culture. So it was like poachers and gamekeepers. So the gamekeepers were the public sector. And actually, the private sector was out there grabbing as much resources, money, and maybe even a few, you know, brown envelopes at the same time.
Well, I couldn't possibly comment on that, Tony, as you know. But I think that changed. I mean, certainly it changed in the 80s and then going forward into the 90s. And really, by the time someone like me, you know, came out of what I was doing and started getting involved with the civil service and stuff like that, it's been well entrained for a very, very long time. And again, I can only reiterate what I've said. They honestly believe that it gives them a better understanding, it brings expertise into the civil service, and also they want to, and the industry is keen to get the people who've been perhaps doing the regulation or been, you know, doing the buying, the purchasing, etc., into there, because they want to know what they need.
Like, it's a bit like having a professional police force, a professional civil service that actually sees the whole public sector or the criminal sector as toxic.
Well, I suppose you just put a thought in my head, and that is that, you know, a lot of the IT industry gets hackers to come and be consultants for them so that they can stop hacking. It's that kind of relationship.
So let's have a listen now to the news yesterday about Thames Water, was that day before.
The Business Secretary, Kemi Badenoch, has said that she's very concerned about the future of Britain's biggest water company, Thames Water, because of reports the firm is on the brink of collapse. Ministers say they have contingency plans, which could include nationalisation, should the utility go bust under the weight of £14 billion of debt. They've insisted water supplies won't be affected. The company says it's working with shareholders to secure funding, but the financial problems have prompted wider questions about the water industry and how important improvements are funded. Our business correspondent Emma Simpson reports.
Thames Water has 15 million customers in London and the Thames Valley. It's under fire for leaks, pumping raw sewage into rivers and executive pay, but it's now under financial pressure as well. Russ Mould from the investment company AJ Bell says the cost of servicing its debts is the main problem.
That interest bill is currently going up because interest rates are going up. Some of its interest payments are related to inflation, which, as we know, is very high. And at the same time, it's having to spend well over £1 billion a year in infrastructure, water mains, stopping leakage. And there's a big regulatory review coming up in a couple of years' time, which will probably mean it has to invest even more.
Thames Water is seeking £1 billion from its shareholders, a consortium of pension and infrastructure funds and private investors. The government is preparing for a worst-case scenario. Kemi Badenoch is the business secretary.
I'm very concerned. Obviously, this is a commercially sensitive situation. My colleagues across government are looking at what we can do, but we need to make sure that Thames Water as an entity survives. The regulator has been focused on keeping consumer bills down, but there's a lot of infrastructure work that needs to take place, and we need that entity to survive and continue going.
In a statement, Thames Water said it was working constructively with shareholders and that the regulator Ofwat was being kept fully informed.
So that's the news bulletin yesterday about this, or the day before. I'm not quite sure when it was on the radio for the 6 o'clock bulletin. The figures are pretty astronomical. It's not just Thames Water that's got these enormous debts that they've got to service. So as interest rates, I mean, it's basically the putting up of interest rates that's sent this organisation into... I love the idea of them going into liquidation, but it's 60 billion in debts. That's around the other water, all the water firms have got around about 60 billion in debt. Martin, Thames is going to need apparently a nearly £4 billion debt write-off.
Well, I ask people to remember that these water companies used to be owned by the government.
Britain was actually
Scotland,
one of the only places.
They still are owned by the government.
Britain was one of the only countries that did privatise.
That's right. And in Wales, the Welsh Water is actually a not-for-profit company. The whole model of privatisation of the water industry was simply wrong. And coming back to what Justin was saying earlier, saying we want industry expertise in the civil service, it was all civil service, wall to wall. Yeah, so you can then make a plan to deal with a plan. You know, economies do need a bit of planning. Yeah, things like energy, water, transport, these things can't just be left to the market. But the philosophy, the ideology of putting them into the market, this is where it ends up. The taxpayer is now going to pick up the bill for this. The shareholders have walked away. It's what's called control fraud. They've been the shareholders have been paid money all the way through this process, and they've all walked away with money in their pockets.
It's a secret email.
That is actually theft from the public.
In the Evening Standard today, a secret email from the Severn Trent Water boss to her rivals, which I think should have big inverted commas around, saying we must stick together to fend off nationalisation.
Well, therefore, nationalisation will happen anyway. And we
you
will
think
end up,
so?
We will, yes.
No, surely it will be just a refinancing.
No. What will happen in the end is all of these things will collapse. It's what happened in the care home sector. It's what happens. If you put fundamental infrastructure into the private sector, there's a whole process whereby it's stripped bare, asset stripped. They've spent money on shareholders rather than on investment
in the there's another scenario here. Maybe the government will be sympathetic to these private water companies and say, well, actually, we'll allow you to put the prices up. And the whole thing will be refinanced, and people will start paying another half or a third or even double
The problem with that, Tony, is that then increases the cost of living crisis, which means you have to increase interest rates.
Well, who do you think the government cares more about, these private companies or the consumers?
Well, the fact is that the financial elites, which have dominated British policy making over the last 30 or 40 years, have basically asset stripped the country. But they will take their money and disappear to the Cayman Islands or whatever.
So if you've got around about £5,000, Martin, sitting in your pocket, which I don't think you do, but if you did have, and you invested it into your local water company's shares, you would end up paying, with the dividends that they're paying at the moment, possibly nothing at all for your water.
Now.
And do you know what? Then that would mean that all the people that were paying for water were subsidising you. So the rich, the wealthy, who buy their Thames Water shares, pay nothing for the water, and that water that they are drinking every day is paid for by the poorer people in that area. It just seems to me you've got what is a totally perverse
It's Robin Hood in reverse. The other thing I'd point out is most people, the whole thing about water meters, you're going to be charged exactly the amount of water you use. That is not the marginal cost of supplying water. If you live in a city like Bristol, in a tower block, supplying water is relatively simple because you've just got one pipe to the block and then you take all the water off it. But if you live in a big house in South Gloss, they've got to put in a whole new sewer to get to you. But you pay the same price for the water as the people in the inner city. So that's another. Yet people think that water is the more water you use, that therefore the real cost is the infrastructure, which is why all this stuff was put in the public sector in the first place.
Is it possible?
It was originally developed.
Martin,
the water industry was originally developed. Municipal socialists.
They're going to fight this tooth and claw. Any kind of idea of nationalisation. And also, of course, we famously had your leader, Keir Starmer, at Davos this year, saying there was no possibility of nationalising at the time. The discussions were about the massive profits that Shell and BP were making.
Well, that's because they are, because of the perversity of the system where they've got to win these swing voters who are all Daily Mail readers and all the rest of it. But
no, it's not.
It is. That's why they have to. That's why they feel.
Think that they were, if they were to say no, we're going to renationalise water, just like it is in many other parts of Europe, that people would support that?
Yes, they would. But the problem is, why should we pay the shareholders off? What you need to do is bank. What should happen is, remember we were talking about this with Oliver Tickell. They should bankrupt the water companies, and then the shareholders shouldn't get anything.
Regulate them down.
Regulate them down to nothing. Yeah. I mean, and ultimately there will be a major crisis here. You can see it brewing. And that on the other side of that, we will actually have to return to the kind of things we were, the kind of economy we had in the 1950s.
There isn't
substantial public sector.
There isn't the will to do that, is there? Either in the present or the next government, the Starmer government.
Well, the Starmer government is, let's call it the Starmer government, even though it's not in power yet. They want to calm down the financial bourgeoisie, that they're not going to scare the horses. That's very much what they're about. And you can see from their point of view why they would do that. But I think they're going to find it's very difficult, because the kind of crisis that's coming down the pike isn't the sort of thing you can deal with by tinkering. What if all the water companies go bust? All of them. What will the government do? Say, we're just not going to supply water? Well, or will they have to take it over and say, gosh, we've got to nationalise it?
Well,
they
need to be thinking about that right now, don't they? There's 60 billion of debt sitting in those water companies, and they're cranking up interest rates, aren't they?
Yeah, so in other words, what will happen at a certain point is there's going to be a crash in this country.
Yes.
Of course there is. And then we'll have to have a completely different economic policy, because you can't cut your way out of a crash. The idea of balancing the books is stupid. They tried to do it in Osborne's austerity policy, actually made the deficit worse, because by pushing the economy down, it increased the government's expenditure on things like unemployment benefit and reduced the tax take.
Is it deliberate?
It is deliberate. It's what they call in the US starving the beast. So they spend a hell of a lot of money on fighting in the Ukraine, going to war in Iraq and all the rest of it, and then they turn around and say, oh, we've got no money for Social Security, sorry, we'll have to cut it because we've got to balance the books. Although they never do balance the books. They continuously unbalance them. Have not been balanced in Japan for 40 years.
Well, they haven't obviously been being balanced in the water industry either, with the 60 billion of debt that's built up. Justin, what do you make of all this?
I'm really sort of loath to put a sort of football comparison on, but I think it's a leveraged buyout, frankly. It seems to me that they got all this infrastructure and they've just mortgaged it to the hilt, and they've borrowed, as Martin says, so that they can just pay the shareholders out. And it seems very much like Manchester United and the buyout that they had about 20 years ago. And effectively, people keep saying that the stadium at Manchester is falling down. Well, look at the sewage. Yeah. Look at the leaks. It's exactly a comparator, for me. And I think they call it a leverage buyout when it was the Glazers coming in and buying Man United.
I think you've got
a leverage buyout in the water industry as well. And the debt's sitting there and the infrastructure's collapsing. And like Martin says, someone's going to have to come in and do something about it. Well, guess who's going to pick up the tab?
Yeah, well, I think maybe they'll just, like in the energy sector, they'll just say, right, the public is going to have to pay double what they used to for water.
The problem with that is then you're squeezing the demand of the ordinary population to buy things. Yeah, if they've got to spend all their money on water.
Well, they're doing that anyway, Martin.
I know, but the point about that is capitalism actually depends upon people having money in their pockets.
people are having to pay thousands of pounds, some of them, more on their mortgage every month. That's doing exactly the same.
Well, there's going to be a crash. That's what's going to happen.
Is it deliberate? Yes.
No, it's the whole policy is deliberate because it's what they call a control fraud.
Yeah.
The people who've made the money will walk away and leave the mess for everybody else to deal with. They've made a load of money out of it. To say, from their point of view, this is a successful strategy.
Personally, I'll be surprised to see any kind of sniff of nationalisation with Goldman Sachs. I mean, Rishi Sunak in charge.
Well, he had to nationalise the whole of the economy during the COVID crisis because he was made.
But I think when he's got a choice between helping his economic friends out in the city by increasing the amount that people have to pay for water, then he'll take that turn. Anyway, your dispute, Justin, which is really why you're here. Can you just tell us about how things are going with that? Because we know that, you know, the civil service is in the way, at the core of the function of the nation. And the idea that people are having to go to work every day, see their colleagues leaving because the pay rates are so low, and a general sort of sense of demoralisation, and simply the fact that many of them just can't pay the bills.
Yeah, that in essence is why we've done what we've done. I mean, effectively, civil service pay, much as the public sector pay, is probably about 26% shy of where it should be over the last 12 years. Ultimately, what we've requested for about the last 3 years is double-digit pay rise. So we went in with a pay demand of 10% for 2022, and eventually, certainly in defence we got 3.6%, so again, nowhere near it, nowhere near inflation, nowhere near what we were demanding, and that inspired PCS to take industrial action right across the civil service. We balloted employer by employer, so this is what they call a disaggregated ballot. But the upshot of that was that we were able to get certain sectors, which were really pivotal, out in like really long strike action. I mean, some of our members have been on strike for a month with some compensation in way of strike pay to them, and that was being done by a levy across the union, yeah, levied across every single member. The upshot was eventually there was a pay remit came out, well, in the budget rather, they said it was absolutely going to be 2% for the civil servants, and then the pay remit was published in about May, and they said that it was going to be 4.5 or 5%. So, you know, I think with my experience as a full-timer, as a paid official, not a member of PCS, I'm going to look at that through the lens of my experience for 20-odd years. I think that's a significant climb down by the government. That's a significant victory for PCS, and there's times in these kind of disputes where you have to recognise the win.
But you're still not keeping up with inflation anywhere near.
No. And I mean, and again, you know, no one is. And I don't believe that inflation is the fault of working people asking for the money they need to survive. You know, absolutely. And yet we look at what the average pay rise has been across the last 12 months, something like 7.2%. You know, appreciating that is an average, and the public sector probably drags it down. If it was just the private sector, it would be a bit more. And clearly there's people high up in the private sector who are still taking home millions. But, you know, clearly our members have sort of sensibilities about the work they do, especially in defence. They feel very loyal. They feel very, you know, like they're a constituents, see that as people who work for the military, who've been in the military, you know, who support the military, and they don't want to do anything that's going to detriment them. In some respects, they're held hostage in that, around that, much as nurses are, much as teachers are, and I was in my previous career. You know, we're told that it's a vocation and we've just got to do it. But I think what we've got is a situation where our members are realistic. It's clearly not inflation. It's clearly not average pay rises. It is a doubling of what the government offered, and that's been achieved through strike action.
Well, why would anyone be a civil servant, work in the public sector, since outside the pay is so much better and the prospects of pay increase is better too?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, if we're going to look at market forces, there's probably some sort of supply and demand. You know, I mean, I guess that the market theory says that the best people go off to the best jobs and then the rest of us just have to pick up whatever's left. I think there's also an amount of vocation involved, you know. And again, you know, especially in defence, we have locations where they're very, very remote. There's not a lot of jobs, you know. There's parts of rural Wales, you know, Lincolnshire, stuff like that. The only job you might get is on a rifle range or an airbase. That can be it. So there's various reasons why some people genuinely love it. And, you know, there's some civil servants who go all the way from the very bottom to the top of the organisation and get very well paid as a result of maybe 20, 30 years service.
Martin, this difference in culture between public and private, what do you think makes people choose the lower paid option?
Well, traditionally, people went to the civil service because it was a job for life with a pension. You know, you knew that when you went into it that's what would happen.
Is the pension part of it, do you think, Justin?
Yeah, I mean, it's part of it, but it's fully contributory now. You know, our civil servants pay for their pension much like anyone else would. There's employer contributions, but it's not the zero contribution it was 30 years ago.
No, but I think the point is the way it used to be. I mean, one of the things that Kwasi Kwarteng did before he put his crazy budget together was he sacked Tom Scholar, who was the head of the Treasury. And he basically worked his way up to be the head of the Treasury. And that was one of the things that made the markets freak out. Because they thought, well, why are you getting rid of this top guy who's, you know, totally respected, worked his way up from the bottom? And, of course, top civil servants used to not be associated with industry so that they could bring industry bosses in and read them the Riot Act. And, of course, that doesn't happen now. This revolving door thing leads to a situation where the culture of the private sector infects the public sector. And I would argue that they've got two different roles. The private sector should just concentrate on making money. They shouldn't be worrying about anything else, just make money. But that means that they have to deal with a public sector, a civil service, which isn't ultimately on that wavelength.
Okay,
and so top civil servants used to get gongs and knighthoods and things rather than the pay they could get in the private sector. But now, of course, that's all broken down. And I don't think it's a good thing that it's broken down, frankly, because a lot of the culture of the private sector is inappropriate for public sector work.
I mean, isn't, to a certain extent, almost bit by bit, all of government seems to be being chipped away at, Justin, being privatised?
Well, I suppose, is that part of the getting rid of big government agenda, you know, trying to make a smaller government and things like that? There's certainly revolving door. There's certainly people who are involved in industry coming into the civil service. They've certainly made that easier over the last, you know, 10, 15 years, and they've certainly encouraged it more. Again, I can only go back to what I said earlier on. They say they want the expertise. I don't think it keeps a purity, and I don't think it keeps a firewall between the two branches of employment. I certainly would advocate for that firewall being there. I'm much more in favour of the old model in the 70s and the 80s, the kind of yes minister model. I really don't think it's appropriate to do this, but they're doing it.
And of course, as a trade unionist, you've got to work with what's there, because your members are working in this structure, and you've got to try and do the best for them within that structure.
So it sounds to me like the mood music is, yes, we're going to accept this offer. So we're talking about 4.5-5% for your members, but in the background you've got something like 12-13, you know, something, say even more percent inflation. It just sounds to me like what you've done is you've created another problem for yourself next year, Justin, like it's been happening for the last 10 years or so.
Yeah, certainly. I think we're really aware that we don't want to sort of compound these problems. We really would like to see an end to this. I mean, obviously, most people in the country want to see inflation come down. I think there's going to be a catastrophic cost to that because they're simply putting up, the interest rates. I heard someone talking about the housing market this morning from Nationwide, trying, you know, manfully to say that this isn't going to affect the housing market, etc., etc. It's difficult to see how that's going to be the case. It's also difficult to see how it's not going to affect unemployment. And you said earlier on about, you know, do they want to crash the economy? Well, they're never going to come right out and say it, but they certainly want to slow it down. And the way they're doing that is through interest rates. that's going to have a massive effect on our members, much as inflation's had a massive effect on our members. And as Martin said, really, I think there's less and less places where people are able to spend their money, but that means those places are making more and more profit. It's essentials. It's essentials that they're really targeting. And I don't know what that means for wider capitalism, as Martin said. You know, I totally agree with him that capitalism is absolutely founded on the ability of putting money in working people's pockets so they spend every penny. And if there's no money going into their pockets, they can't spend it. I don't understand how the capitalists think the system's going to keep turning.
No, they don't, do they, Martin?
Yeah, and I think in the past and in Scandinavia, the way they dealt with this kind of dilemma was through incomes policies, yeah? So you'd have national bargaining in a country like Sweden, where the trade union economists and the employer organisation economists would get together and they would agree about what the rate of productivity increase had been in whatever industry it was. And then they insisted on paying that rate across everybody. So that, but well-run companies, which had got higher productivity, only had to pay the going rate. Badly run companies, which weren't getting the level of productivity, they had to pay the going rate as well. So they're deliberately bankrupted. And it's actually a system for getting rid of the weak. It's actually, and of course, it's a full employment system as well. So during the 70s, wages went up with inflation automatically because of the agreements that were made between the trade union leadership and the government. That's broken down. And what's happened since 1973 is as productivity has increased, as it normally does year on year, all of that wealth that's been generated has been sucked up by the financial sector. The real wages in the United States haven't risen since 1973.
I'm not sure it's actually
and
going...
that wasn't the case
Martin,
before.
I'm not even sure it's going into any individuals' pockets apart from maybe a few super rich. It seems to be going into the bank accounts of these enormous private equity firms, hedge funds, etc. You know, almost
I mean, ultimately, these
financial institutions are sucking up this, and they're getting bigger and bigger. We did have a little reference to The Corporation, the film from Canada from 2002, a few weeks ago, which talks about this, the idea that the corporations are just starting to becoming, bit by bit, to own everything. Anyway, one of the major factors in all of this has got to be energy prices, and it is energy prices. Luckily, the Labour leader-in-waiting, who will most likely become Prime Minister next year as the Conservative Party continues to collapse and fall apart in a kind of controlled demolition, Keir Starmer, and he gave a speech last week about his energy policy, amazingly, and we'll hear about that afterwards. Much of this was released the same day by the Tony Blair Institute.
Let me say directly to those people in Scotland nervous about the change this mission requires. I know the ghosts industrial change unearths. As a young lawyer, I worked with the mining communities to challenge the Tories pit closure programme. But deep down, we all know this has to happen eventually, and that the only question is when. So in all candour, the reality is this. The moment for decisive action is now. If we wait until North Sea oil and gas runs out, the opportunities this change can bring for Scotland and your community will pass us by. And that would be a historic mistake. An error for the future of Scotland as big as the Thatcher government closing down the coal mines while frittering away the opportunity of the North Sea. My offer, the Labour offer, is this. A credible plan to manage the change, to protect good jobs, create good jobs, no cliff edges. But at the same time, to harness the wealth that's in our air, our seas and our skies, and use it to serve the interests of your community. Because what's true in Scotland is true right across the grassroots of Britain. We can use the opportunity of clean energy to create jobs, to deliver security, bring back hope to communities that got ripped apart by the deindustrialisation of the 1980s. This is a future we can win. But I also have to warn you,
politicians are saying exactly the same thing to their people in northern France, in eastern Germany, the Rust Belt of America. Now, we have tremendous advantages here. Our coast, our shallow waters, our universities, our creativity, the depth of our skills, the graft of our people, the superpower sciences, the technological edge, and yes, if you can believe it, even our weather.
So there's Keir Starmer there, Sir Keir Starmer, leader of the Labour Party, launching his policy. Do you think, Martin, is any significance to the fact that much of this document was released in parallel that day with on the Tony Blair Foundation website? It just seems he's working quite closely with Blair.
I imagine
this sort of thing.
I imagine that they'll have coordinated with them.
I thought Blair was gone. He was a completely failed politician that was de-elected.
He's still out there, and obviously people at Starmer's office will be talking to his people and saying, "What do you think we should do?" And of course, Starmer wants to be seen as different from Blair, but of course, it's very clear the direction of travel he's taking the Labour Party.
And what do you make of the main thrust of what he's saying here, that things like nuclear, wind power and solar is the future?
Well, I mean, this is almost like kind of, you know, this is the general consensus, is this is what's going to happen. I suspect it isn't going to happen because capitalism itself is in such poor state that they're going to have to take emergency measures of all kinds just to keep the show on the road.
I mean, it's interesting you say
that.
The
idea that we're going to have some plan that's going to create all of these jobs.
Some bright spark, somebody maybe in the civil service, Justin, figured out that we mustn't shut down the Drax power station because if we did, then we would end up with nights and days where there wasn't any electricity to go around the country. So there seems to be a sort of fundamental flaw, especially when you've got a growing population of having a new kind of energy system that actually doesn't deliver the electricity that people need, Martin.
Well, I think these are bigger issues, you know, the sort of climate change agenda or whatever it is. Underlying all of this is the fact that we've decided in the West that we're not going to buy cheap Russian oil and gas, which has actually underpinned Germany's prosperity since 1945, and certainly since the 70s. Now, if you decide to do that, you can then say, well, we're going to move in one leap, we're going to move to having completely renewable energy. Well, I should say, that's not going to work. It's not a viable plan. You're going to even if you were going to move towards having completely renewable energy, which is disputable whether you should do that, but even if you're going to do it, you're doing it as an emergency measure in the middle of a war isn't going to work. We're going to end up with things like petrol rationing. That's what's going to happen. And ultimately, they will have to control oil and gas if we're going to go to war with Russia. And, of course, on the other side of their mouth, this is what all these people are talking about.
I mean, I just wonder
Keir Starmer doesn't want to talk about it, but that's what's going on.
I wonder how realistic all this is, Justin, if you'd like to comment on the energy, you know, energy market, energy policy. Where are we going to actually, you know, where's the electricity going to come from that runs our light bulbs? Whatever else, maybe our cookers, our gas cookers, this sort of thing. But we're talking here specifically, at least as Starmer is, about electricity. Is it viable, do you think, to have this? Well, he calls it clean energy. It's not, of course, totally clean. I mean, you have to laugh, don't you? Because there's some horrific lithium mining going on. There's also a lot of effort and energy goes into creating these windmills, and they have to be serviced and they have to be replaced. And the same with solar panels. They are extremely toxic when they come to the end of their life, after 15 years or so. Some are longer extended. Then they are also toxic and they have to be dealt with. It's not clean at all. So what do you make of all this move to wind power, solar power, nuclear?
I mean, personally, I'm really in favour of renewables. I totally understand some of the issues around it. I mean, they call nuclear renewable. I'm really not convinced about that. And then, as you say, you've got issues with, you know, the construction. You've still got to move stuff. You know, it doesn't matter if you're building a concrete base for a nuclear power station or for a wind farm. And as you say, you've got the solar issues as well. I'm really concerned that they are just going to back away from all of the protocols and promises that they've made. I'm really concerned that effectively I keep cycling to work and thinking they're just going to let us burn. You know what I mean? I'm really concerned about it. The Tories keep putting stuff up, you know, attacking Starmer for his links with Just Stop Oil, etc., etc. I don't believe that there are any links with Just Stop Oil, just because he gets money from the same people. Well, and Tories get money from here, there, and everywhere, and it's as corrupt as hell. But ultimately, you're saying to me, what's my personal view? I would love everyone to be cycling everywhere and be like working as close to home as possible, etc., etc. You know, the reality is that I think they are going to keep the fossil fuel industries going for decades, and I think the situation's just going to get worse and worse.
Well,
and worse.
There is
pretty
another,
depressing.
Another side to all of this, and that is that the Americans will start supplying more and more of our gas, more and more of our coal, more and more of our oil. And actually the idea here is to shut down domestic production. I remember when I was over in New Zealand last year, it was a great people bemoaning the fact that, well, we've got our own oil fields, we don't produce a lot, but they've decided to shut them down. We have to now import all of our oil. What is that doing for the environment? Nothing. So, you know, people making this sort of point.
As you squeeze down the oil industry through you know, basically planning, the profitability of what's left goes up because you're reducing the supply.
Oh,
which is why the oil industry is quite blasé about this transition. As long as they're allowed to supply something, they're probably making more money out of oil and gas now than they have ever done.
Making more money out of oil and gas than they've ever done. In fact, we're talking now about
they're not bothered by restricting the supply, because the Russians are making more money selling less oil and gas than they were before, because the price has gone up and it compensates them for the fact that they're selling less.
Anyway, some chappy from the Times was quizzing Starmer up in Scotland, and he gave his energy talk in parallel and kind of synchronicity with Tony Blair releasing it all on his Tony Blair Foundation website, which I just found too hilarious to be true. You know, the idea that Blair is, I mean, I think if most people realised that Blair was involved in all of these policies Starmer was doing, it would be a toxic effect on Starmer. But anyway, so the chap from the Times quizzed him a little bit about whether he was actually competent to deliver any of this.
Kieran from the Times.
Thanks very much. This morning, journalists were promised a hydrogen bus to bring them down here today. And in fact, what was waiting for them was a diesel vehicle with a driver who didn't know where they were going. Given that Labour appears to have spent the last few weeks squabbling over the details of this after what Anas called an unhelpful briefing to the Sunday Times a few weeks ago, why should anyone trust Labour to be across the details to make these ambitious plans work?
Can I just first of all say there's a hydrogen bus company here, so we'll, I'm sure we'll talk to them and make sure we're recruiting more hydrogen buses across our public transport infrastructure for every part. But I don't know if Keir wants to come back on the wider point.
On the wider point, look, you've got the team working on this mission right here in this room, all speaking this morning, all speaking with one voice. And this is an ambitious plan which is set out in detail, not only in the various words that we've all said this morning, all complimenting words, by the way, but also in the document that underpins it, that sets out the nuts and bolts. And, you know, this is an exciting plan for the future. It shows an opposition ready for government, already planning for government, and talking to the sector about how we implement these plans, because what we don't want to do is to get to the next election, and if we're privileged enough to win it, and it will be a privilege to serve, to then start our discussion. So it's the complete opposite, Kieran, of the picture you paint. This is a strong plan, it's an agreed plan, and we are already talking to the sector about how we implement it. And across the sector, they want to hear that argument. We went to Scunthorpe Steelworks, Ed and I, last week. I'll give you just an example of why this is so important. Their customers want decarbonised steel, and they can't produce decarbonised steel. And the workforce want to change because they want their jobs. They want their factory, their steelworks to survive. And it will only survive if they go through this change. So they're not saying to us, please save the jobs we've got. They're saying, please help us have the jobs now and for the future. And that's the level of engagement that we're involved in the delivery of this plan. So I'm very confident in this plan. It's a very united team as we go forward. And I think, Kieran, as you go through the document, which you probably haven't had the chance to get, the background document, you'll see it's a huge amount of detail there about how we're going to implement it.
Well, I'm not sure if he meant decarbonised steel or decustomised steel. I'm not sure if he knows the difference, or I certainly don't know the difference. But anyway, confident, Martin, that Starmer knows what he's doing? I mean, I get the impression they're just as incompetent as the Tories on things like immigration, that actually what we're doing is there's a whole class of politicians now that over the last 10, or maybe even as many, just as many, you know, maybe 20 years or so, that have absolutely no competence whatsoever, and the whole thing is deliberate. What's happening is government is being discredited by every one of these individuals.
Well, I think the idea that Starmer could be as incompetent as the current government is simply wrong. I don't think he's incompetent. I think he's relatively competent compared to people like Kwasi Kwarteng and Liz Truss. He ain't going to do anything stupid. But the problem is, he ain't going to do anything much at all. He's going to try and manage the crisis of capitalism.
Well, he seems pretty obvious.
He doesn't have any idea about what to... I'm sure if they become the government, they're going to be blown off course almost immediately by the level of international crisis that they're going to inherit, and national crisis that they're going to inherit. The idea that this is going to be a sort of steady-as-she-goes election and the Labour Party will put a stable hand on the tiller and just steer the ship forward, that's what they're projecting, but I don't think they're going to be able to do it.
My conspiracy theory is that there are absolutely incompetent people being deliberately put into power to discredit the whole idea of government, of voting, to demoralise the voters, and actually to empower the big multinationals. But, you know, we're talking about now the Shells, the BPs, the Amazons, the people that now really seem to call the shots in lobbying government anyway.
Well, the idea that the government can't do anything, that's definitely been the mantra of the Tories since the 1980s, that we must get government off people's backs. Although, of course, the size of the government hasn't reduced. The amount it spends has been pretty much the same, but they've spent it on their mates through subcontracting.
This has become a Labour thing too, hasn't it? It wasn't under Corbyn, but it is again now.
No, yes, because the Corbyn era is exactly what they're trying to, you know, like with garlic, trying to get the vampire back in the coffin. Yeah. So what Starmer is trying to do is forget all that radical stuff. I mean, the sort of thing Corbyn was talking about, well, why can't we have free broadband for everybody? It's a no-brainer. They should just do it.
Okay.
But he doesn't want to talk about that. He's talking about we're going to have a more interventionist government, but we're not going to frighten the horses and nationalise things and freak out the financial
people.
Look
at Sunak and this Rwanda policy, for example. The entire migration policy seems to have been hinged on this for the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. When it first came out, the idea of sending everyone to Rwanda was just sort of, you know, you think, well, this is ridiculous. You can't just send people to Rwanda. You need to process them here, don't you? And yet it's carried on for a couple of years as the policy. And now, today, we've just been told, Justin, that the whole thing is unlawful and you're not going to do it, not even once. So I know your union's been involved in it the whole bit. I think a bit, hasn't it?
Yeah, we really have. And the main aspect of that has been to try and protect our members who work for Border Force, really, in having to carry out an unlawful policy. I mean, this started with the pushback policy. We intervened in that because they wanted to put our members into boats and try and get them to break international maritime law. We were successful in that. We lost in September 22 in the High Court. But this was the appeal of that, and we've found, you know, it's been found that the Rwanda policy is unlawful, and PCS are really proud to have been part of highlighting, I think, what most reasonable people already know.
Do you want to just wind up by talking a little bit about what sort of, how much roughly monthly it costs to join a union like yours? What do you get for your money?
Well, you get me, Tony. What do you need, you know?
Isn't it like an insurance policy?
I would always say that's definitely the second tier, okay? I'm always trying to sell this to people on the political aspect of it, yeah? We've got to have collectivisation. You are weak in the workplace if you're on your own. Together we're stronger. You know, it's all of that old kind of rhetoric, you know, together we're stronger, et cetera, et cetera. So that's always my first thing. We've got to have meetings. We've got to collectivise. We've got to bargain with the employer. Our strength is in our numbers. Their strength is in their industrial power, and we only combat that by joining together. So that's the first step. Yeah, look, the second tranche is always going to be insurance, yeah? People don't understand what they're going to get themselves into, and, you know, we get members, you know, in their 60s, the first time they've ever been in trouble in work in their entire lives, you know, 40, 45 years, and they come to us and they really had no notion that any employer could do what they're doing, things like capability, stuff around sickness management, absence, you know. And then lastly, we have a range of benefits that most organisations or clubs would have, you know. Again, it's definitely not the selling point for me. It's all about the politics. It's all about collectivising and strength.
Come on, what's the bottom line? How much?
I think the most that we're charging at the moment is £16 a month, and there is a levy on top because, as I said to you, we've been supporting the strike. So you're basically looking at £20 a month. I want to say this, Tony. When I was in the fire brigade union, and I've been out of there nearly 10 years, but certainly going back into the 2000s, we were paying £30 a month. So I think it's a pretty good deal. And obviously, there's an economy of scale. So join your union. Let's have more people involved. It'll be cheaper for everyone, and we can beat the bosses.
But the only thing is, you're only going to get a 4.5% pay.
Oh, that's this year. If we can double our membership, which, to be fair, we've got the capacity to do that in defence, then we'll certainly be getting a lot more.
Okay, well, thanks ever so much. And stay with us for a little while, because we're now joined by, Dr David Miller, ex-professor of Bristol University, who was sacked a couple of years ago now for speaking out about anti-Semitism or about actually the Zionist lobby within the university. Hi, David.
Hello.
Could you just give us a little bit of an introduction into? I mean, you have been sending me some fascinating things over the last few days, which we'll be talking about in a minute. But your take on this cost of living crisis, because I'm putting forward conspiracy theories here, saying the whole thing is deliberate. Actually, the government doesn't really care about its voters. That the corporations now become so powerful that they can just price fix, and there's nothing much the government can do about it.
Well, when you say it's deliberate, you have to specify who is making it deliberate. Is it the government? Is it the UK government? Is it the US government? Is it the EU? Is it the corporations? You need to specify.
Corporations, Shell, BP, energy companies.
Be specific, yeah. Right. So, but that's not the only reason why we have a cost of living crisis, right? We have a cost of living crisis, yes, because of the corporations. The corporations are evil, yes. That's obviously true. Have been for a long time.
Inflation rates too.
They're in charge. Have been in charge since Thatcher allowed them to be in charge from 1979 onwards, and then Blair and Brown, of course, followed the same path. But look, we're in a situation which is also influenced significantly by geopolitics, right? So part of the reason that we have the extremes of the cost of living crisis that we do is because of the conflict in Ukraine. So here are the people in the EU who pushed forward with neoliberalism and privatisation and contracting out, all the things that we've seen in this country and we led on in this country, and then were transferred all the way through the EU. And these are the people who are the ideologues, who believe in free markets, who understand free markets, and who are able to put in place free markets in order to, you know, to make sure the PCS members get lesser wages and the bosses get more. But when it came to Ukraine, what happened was that they decided that they were going to sanction Russia. Now, if you understand capitalism, you have to understand that you can only sanction a country that isn't self-sufficient. Now, in terms of some things, Russia wasn't self-sufficient, but in terms of oil, in terms of fertilizers, the wherewithal to produce an industrial society and feed its people, Russia is self-sufficient, along with Belarus and the other countries. And of course, it's since, of course, trade started massive increase of trading with other oil-producing countries, Iran, the Saudis, and even China. And as a result, the sanctions have been a total disaster for European economies and have exacerbated the cost of living crisis. Now, when you look at this, you think, how can these people who are supposed to know about capitalism have failed so systematically to understand capitalism? And the reason, I think, is that because we've failed to understand that capitalism doesn't exist, neoliberalism doesn't exist, outside of a geopolitical context. And that geopolitical context is unipolarity and the power of US imperialism. And really what we've seen here with the sanctions is the US punishing European economies. And it's, of course, it's the same as they've done with the Nord Stream pipeline. They've blown up the pipeline, which has destroyed the ability of Germany to have an industrial economy. So we're seeing our ally, our great ally in the US, which is with us and standing and with the people of Ukraine, actually helping to destroy European economies and destroying the lifestyles and the life standards of the working class across the whole of Europe. So that's, for me, is the other part of this. It's not just that the corporations are bad people and are trying to screw us every day, which of course they are. It's also the context of geopolitics, which is the Ukraine war.
So is it possible for these corporations and banksters to fight on these two fronts at the same time? Because effectively they're in conflict with their own population. It may take the population a little while to catch up to what's going on. But they're also in population with one of the world's great superpowers now, a nuclear-armed superpower that, as you say, is quite happily self-sufficient, actually. So can they fight both those fronts at the same time?
Well, when you say they, I mean the people who run the corporations, some of these corporations you mentioned are European-based. BP and Shell, for example, are based in the UK and in the Netherlands. But these are transnational corporations. They don't owe loyalty to this country, to the UK, to France or Germany. They owe loyalty to their transnational club. That's where there is potentially some kind of conflict between transnational capital and US imperial power. But of course, you know, the largest proportion of the capitalists and the corporations are based in the US still, as the biggest economy. And so you have a sense in which a lot of the corporations are acting in the interests of the US, but not all of them. So they have a conflict of interest, yes, but they that's not something which we're going to see anything of, except, you know, you'd hear about it in, when you go to the Bilderberg Group, Tony, and you hang out and outside.
Yeah.
Inside, you hear some of these conflicts, but we don't hear much of it outside.
No. Justin, what do you make of the geopolitics David's been talking about there, saying actually, essentially, there seems to be much better organisation amongst these transnational, the idea of the nation state basically is going out the window. To paraphrase you, David, I'm not sure if you quite said that, but that's the direction it seems to be heading.
I mean, certainly we hear about the piles of cash, and I mean, we were kind of touching on it earlier, weren't we, about how wealthy some of these corporations are. I mean, you hear about corporations that have got more money than fairly substantial countries and stuff like that. So, I mean, again, you know, I absolutely don't know as much as David does about the geopolitical stuff. I'm always keen to focus on the effect that it's having on our members. You know, I'm not trying to be parochial or anything like that. I've got a keen interest in what goes on in the world, but ultimately I've got to bring it down to what faces our members, and that is inflation, and that is the cost of living, and that is the increasing cost of interest and housing. You know, I don't care if it's rented or mortgaged. These are the things that we're working about. It's really interesting to hear about some of the causes of it. And I would dearly love our members to understand that, because sometimes they just don't. But that's a real education piece that we need to do. But ultimately, it's about the cost of living.
Well, we have a lot of hot air from me, from sociologists, from economists, etc. But at the end of the day, whether or not you can afford a roof over your head is one of the most important aspects of all of this. And it came up on the BBC 6 o'clock news last night.
There's fresh evidence that many people on low incomes are being priced out of the rental market. The Institute for Fiscal Studies, a think tank, says just 5% of all new rental properties on the website Zoopla in the first quarter of the year were affordable for those needing housing benefit or universal credit to pay their rent. Here's our social affairs correspondent, Michael Buchanan.
For those households entirely reliant on benefits to pay their rent, it seems there's never been a worse time to look for a home. While housing benefit rates have been frozen since 2020, the IFS say private rents have increased by 20% in the same period. It means the number of affordable properties in Britain on Zoopla fell from 23% in 2020 to just 5% earlier this year, with families in Wales struggling the most to find homes that benefits will cover entirely. As the pool of available houses shrinks, low-income families are more likely to be living in properties that are in a state of disrepair and more expensive than average to heat, according to the IFS. Ministers say they're spending £11.5 billion delivering affordable rented homes across the country. But the increasingly acute housing problem was underlined by other data published today, which shows the number of people sleeping rough in London last year increased by 21%.
Well, that's just, so an extra fifth of people sleeping rough in London just in a year. David Miller, this is something that doesn't often really get properly looked at, does it? We're in a situation where those forced onto benefits, living on benefits, or many of the lower paid are simply, they're finding it now impossible to find somewhere to live. If they have to move, if a landlord evicts them, needs to use the house, wants to sell the house, etc., there's nowhere for them to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's a vicious attack on the poorest in the society. And I mean, this is what, I mean, I'm old enough to remember when there were no homeless people on the streets of Edinburgh and Glasgow where I lived. There were no homeless people on the streets of most of the major cities. In London, there were some. But the Tories systematically increased the number of homeless. They forced people out of mental health institutions with their care in the community policy, which of course essentially meant people who had mental health problems were just abandoned in the society and still haven't been properly dealt with.
Yeah, Virginia Bottomley.
Well, yeah, there are many, many names of Tory infamy we can list that took part in that policy. And this is increasing, you know, as you say, 20% in the last year. That's just truly extraordinary, a staggering society. I mean, when you read back on the awfulness of the 1930s, when you read George Orwell's book or, you know, any of those books, or even go back to Engels' stuff about the condition of the working class in England, you know, we are back in that situation. I mean, it's incredible that we had a period between 1945 and 1979 where inequality declined as a result of social democratic governments, you know, including the Tories who bought into those policies to some extent. And since then, we've had a massive widening of the gap between rich and poor. So it's back to, I don't know the figures, but isn't it worse now than the Victorian era? So we have an appalling attack on the poorest in our society, led, of course, by the Tories and their friends in the hedge funds and in the banks. And they will never stop this. They will only increase their punishment of the poor unless we stop them. That's why unions like the PCS, with a new radical agenda, are so important to this agenda to fighting back. But we need to generalise this struggle across the whole of the society in order that we can push back against the bosses. Otherwise, they will just continue to do this.
Yeah, well, they are, and that's called the Strikes Bill, Justin, isn't it? We've got legislation coming through the pipelines which is going to make it even more difficult to go on strike.
Yeah, with the minimum service level guarantee and... I mean, the government have argued that many other countries across Europe have this. It's nowhere near the sort of draconian measures that they want to bring in this country. It's not going to affect certain aspects of the civil service as much as some other areas, teaching, for example, railways. But, I mean, it might. They'll probably try and impose it on driving examiners, for example, who are our members, you know, and we've got them right across the region, right across the country. It's just another one in the continuing line of attacks that have gone on, as David said, since about, what, 82, 83, you know, when they really got this momentum going. And to be honest with you, I think they're scratching around now, looking at it and going, oh, what else can we change? What else can we change? You know, oh, let's have a minimum service level guarantee, etc. I don't know where they go after this. But I would say one thing. No matter what they do, trade unions keep managing to get members out on industrial action. You know, they thought the 50% was going to be the end of us. Well, that's just made us organise even harder. You know, and frankly, you know, I hope you take this in the right way, and I hope the listeners do as well. Throw as many barriers in the way as you like, because we will find a way to overcome them, and it will make us stronger and better organised, and we will fight back.
Mm. Amazing that the government's attitude, rather than to find some sort of an argument, as Mick Lynch was saying the other week, is just to stop you doing it, to try and bring in a new law to stop you. Well, we'll see how far we get with that. Anyway, Justin Thomas, regional organiser for the southwest of England, thank you very much for joining us. We'll go over to have a listen now to this is a clip for you, David, particularly, and you, Martin, to Keir Starmer channeling Tony Blair. This is a discussion on Talk Radio earlier this week, last week, sorry, about is Starmer channeling Blair? This is a discussion between Mike Graham and John Rentoul. Mike Graham then goes into his knowledge of people like Peter Mandelson and Alistair Campbell back in the Blair government, phoning up journalists to threaten them with their jobs if they reported a story in a certain way, which I found quite fascinating too. So this is from last week on Blair being channeled by Starmer.
The problem with the House of Lords is it's got too many Lib Dems in it, isn't it?
It's got far too many Lib Dems and crossbenchers and independents and all that.
I mean, it hasn't got too many Tories in it, has it?
It's got a lot, because the Conservatives have been in government.
Basically got too many people, period, hasn't it?
Well, yes.
I mean, should they not? I mean, would it make...
It shouldn't be there.
But would it not make more sense if Keir Starmer actually said, I'll tell you what we're going to suggest, is we're going to suggest a freeze on sending people to the House of Lords.
Yeah, but he can do a freeze after he's packed it with some Labour people first.
Right. So is he going to put Gordon Brown in there?
I presume
if he's talking to Tony Blair, Tony Blair's saying, whatever you do, don't give Gordon Brown a peerage. You know, we still don't talk to each other.
I don't think...
They still don't talk to each other, do they?
Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, yes they do, but I mean, they... It's only under specific circumstances. It's quite formal. Yeah. But none of those new Labour people want peerages. You know, Alistair Campbell, Alan Melbourn, Tony Blair.
Well, Alistair Campbell shouldn't get one.
Well, of course he should.
Why?
Because he's a very talented politician.
No, he's not. But he's a just individual who turns on people in a horrible way, who bullies people and has always bullied people, and is, frankly speaking, a man who should have to answer for what he did during the Iraq War.
Yeah, which was to sex up a document. We've had this argument before.
Yeah, no, but it's not an argument.
You're not right.
No, it's not an argument. It's the situation which is the real world in which you don't live, because you love Tony Blair so much and you think everybody associated with him should be given some kind of honour.
I think Alistair Campbell is an extremely talented individual.
No, I think he's extremely flawed.
Should have been an MP.
No, he's an extremely flawed individual. If he wants to stand for election, then let him do it. But what he shouldn't do is grandstand, which is what he does do, bully people on television, which you know he used to do when he was in Number 10.
I know he used to do it because
I've heard him doing it.
No.
Because I've heard him ringing people up and I've heard him saying things to them that were, quite frankly, absolutely unforgivable. As a public civil servant.
I have no...
Well, I can give you absolute chapter and verse on that. I can name you several people who have been in receipt of those calls.
He stood up to Adam Bolton on television once.
He did once do that, most
entertaining.
But that was after he was out of Downing Street. When he was in Downing Street, he used to phone up the BBC on a regular basis and berate them for not leading with stories that he'd given them.
You mean he did his job?
That's not his job to bully people. Not his job to bully people. He rang several people that I...
He
rang several people that I personally know on newspapers and threatened to get them sacked if they didn't do what he said, particularly over Lord Mandelson and a particular story in Japan, and I know that for a fact.
Well, I don't.
So, well, I'm telling you it's true.
Well, I...
So you can impugn me and my veracity if you wish, but you'd be wrong to do so. And I think to defend Alistair Campbell doesn't do you any favours, seriously.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm going to defend him.
All right, well, I hope he doesn't end up in the House of Lords, because I might have to start publishing some of the stuff I know about him.
Right, okay, well, he's not going to the House of Lords because he doesn't want to, so...
Well, that's good. Excellent. He can carry on writing for the European and making a nuisance of himself elsewhere. Anyway, so...
That's John Rental and Mike Graham chit-chatting week before last, David, about the... This is actually quite a pernicious concept, isn't it? The idea of senior politicians at the time and their director of communication phoning up journalists and saying, look, if you print a word of that, I have got ways of getting you sacked. And in fact, what he's saying there is, effectively the same to Alistair Campbell. If you go into the House of Lords, I know a whole load of dirt on you, which I'm going to publish. So this sort of thing seems to be almost like de rigueur now, that journalists can expect phone calls if they print a story. And potentially those networks or publishers that they're working for don't really seem to back them up. They seem to be quite happy to accept journalists being phoned up and intimidated.
Well, I mean, I think that what's happened over the last 20 or 30 years is that the media establishment has become more and more integrated into the what should we call it? Cyril Mills's phrase, perhaps, the power elite. So that there's much more of, I mean, he mentioned it in that discussion, didn't he? The notion of a bubble and people living in that Westminster bubble. They're so close, personally, politically, relationships and marriages, people moving from between jobs through the revolving door, from the corporations to lobbying to journalism to politics, what I think really is surprising about this stuff about Campbell threatening people is that he had any need to do so. I mean, the overwhelming balance of the media, even at the time of Iraq, when there was still some opposition in the mainstream media, was overwhelmingly in favour of the lies that were told by Alistair Campbell, by Tony Blair, by the US administration, the famous moment at the UN Security Council with the photographs of the alleged chemicals being moved. I mean, right from Colin Powell. I mean, that was a huge victory for propaganda. But now we're in a period where the kind of opposition that there was at that stage is nowhere to be seen. It's much worse now than over Ukraine, for example, than it was over Iraq. Within days of the two different dodgy dossier and the other dossier, both of which were full of lies, being released, it was revealed that they were full of lies. But in fact, in one case, by a postgraduate student at a British university. Now, and that was then got into the mainstream media. Now, you can't imagine that the truth about what's happening in Ukraine and the Nazis and the Ukrainian government. If people discover that, in fact, people already know it and knew it before the invasion, the Russian invasion, it simply can't be mentioned in the mainstream. And there's a kind of, Orwell talked about the memory hole, didn't he? And doublespeak. I mean, you simply cannot mention what's happening in Ukraine, or people will jump down on you and say, "Oh, you're pro-Russian," or you're using Putin talking points and all this kind of stuff. So there's a real inability to have any proper debate on matters of public importance now.
But surely the whole point is that we've got these new organisations like BBC Verify. They're the ones that do the proper fact checking. There's an office above the BBC newsroom where these facts get checked.
Well, I mean, all of these fact-checking organisations, and I would include BBC Verify in this, are organisations which are, to a greater or lesser degree, and this is not true for BBC Verify, but with the other ones, to a greater or lesser degree, directly funded by the state and by the intelligence services. These are all organisations which are set up to purvey disinformation and misinformation under the guise of fact-checking. Let me use the example of Ukraine. I've just recently been doing some research on this. There are several organisations in Ukraine which are claimed to be journalistic organisations run by volunteers who just want the truth about what's happening. But actually, in every single case, these are run directly by government. And in fact, in the Ukrainian case, by Banderites, by actual Nazis, who are there to whitewash the existence of Nazis in the Ukraine. And these are organisations which are funded directly by the CIA through the National Endowment for Democracy, and indeed directly by the Foreign Office. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing that all these organisations are funded by one participant in the conflict, and that's the Western participant in the conflict.
Now, you contacted me about this UPA OUNB. What's that? It's five letters with a slash in the middle.
Well, I mean, this is the Ukrainian Nazis, right? I mean, the ones who were proto-Nazis before the Second World War were involved in pogroms against the Jews. I think that it said 50,000 Jews were killed by these people. And then in the Second World War, they were involved in assassinating and killing and murdering Jews and indeed others, Slavs, Poles. I mean, given the role of Poland in the current Ukrainian conflict, extraordinary that the history is that the OUNB, which is the Bandera faction of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, was involved in killing Poles as well as Slavs and Jews in the Second World War. And this is these are the organizations which are looked to by the people who have essentially the whip hand in Ukraine now as being an inspiration, people who are involved in pogroms against the Jews and who are actual Nazis.
Martin, this whole idea of the Nazis in Ukraine, it seems that we've got, as David's saying there, the Nazis are actually trying to pretend that it's not they're not there and it's not happening.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Poles, there was at least 100,000 Poles were murdered by the OUN, and of course the right wing in Poland have still got they think in terms of Lviv being Lvov, which was essentially a Polish majority town with a large Jewish population. And the one stage of the crisis, there was a willingness in the West to look at the Ukrainian nationalists with a somewhat objective eye, pretty similar to the Croatian nationalists in Yugoslavia. They got a very pretty good press, but there was also an understanding that they were not necessarily squeaky clean, because obviously they ethnically cleansed the Serbs out of the Krajina. I drove through the Krajina just after it had happened, very sinister, because everybody, it totally emptied the place out. And the Serbs had lived in that part of the world for over 1,000 years. And the West, NATO, supported the Croatians to drive them out. And, so but there was an understanding that you know, wars are messy and there are different factions and they're going to, you know, and the whitewashing of the right wing in the Ukraine is extraordinary given the history. And you can see why the Russians are becoming increasingly not enraged, but they're just determined that they're not going to give in to this kind of thing. And the Ukrainian right wing don't necessarily speak on behalf of the ordinary people in the Ukraine, but they've been given very powerful roles in the security structure. They control things like the SBU, which is the secret police, and so on. And the Ukraine, Zelensky said today, there's going to be no elections in the Ukraine until the war's over. Well, that means never then. Yeah, he's in power for the duration, unless somebody assassinates him from his own side or whatever. The whole situation is very tense and dangerous.
A lot of people talk about Nazis. What David, is their actual ideology? Is it a racial ideology? Is it a nationalist ideology? Is it based on being anti-Bolshevik, as the original Nazis were? Or is it just anti-Russian? What's actually driving them?
Well, yes, they're anti-Bolshevik. Yes, they're anti-Russian. I mean, they're actually also anti-Semitic, I mean, deeply. And that's what the extraordinary thing about it is, that the Ukrainian nationalism and Zionism show very strong parallels. Zionism comes effectively from the Ukraine to a large extent, and Poland to some extent, Hungary. And they had early alliances with the Ukrainian nationalists. And there's a famous cartoon in the Soviet newspaper from 1925 where there's Vladimir Jabotinsky from Odessa in Ukraine at the grave of Simeon Petliura, who was involved in the killings, the pogroms against 50,000 Jews in the 1920s. And in the cartoon, Jabotinsky is there crying at the grave of Petliura, with whom he made an alliance. Now, so the extraordinary thing is that there's that history, and that history has a contemporary resonance. There were 40 Jews fighting with the Azov battalion in Mariupol last year. Do people know that? Of course they don't. And so on the one hand, they have this kind of anti-Semitic ideology, and if they take power, there is no doubt they would act on that. On the other hand, there are some sections of the Zionists and the Jews in Ukraine who are on that side. Now, of course, there are some Zionists, very few actually. For example, Edward Dolinsky, who is one of the Zionist leaders there, who has been calling out the rise of Nazism in Ukraine for many years, and of course he's been threatened by the Nazis as a result of that. But that's an extraordinary account, really, of what's been happening there, is that there are some Zionists who are actually on board with the Azov battalion, and that's really, I think, very disturbing. But in terms of the Banderites, the people who follow Bandera, who led the OUNB, I mean, these are people who are running, as I said, the propaganda operation. So there's an organization called Inform Napalm. There's an organization called Merot Ferets, which is the kill list, which has been run there, which both of which are Ukrainian Ministry of Defense projects and are run by people who are active ideological Banderites, and these are organizations who are not just Nazi organizations doing disinformation work. They're actually directly supported, as I said, by the CIA through the NAD and by the Foreign Office, but also by British officials. So, I mean, the thing I did the other day, I showed that there's a guy called Cormac Smith, used to be work for MI6 in this country, and he went over there in 2016-18, and he's still, to this day, doing soft peddling on Nazism, and him and many other British officials are quite happy to use the Nazi greeting, the Slava Ukraini, Heroyam Slava, which of course, back in the day, was accompanied by a Nazi salute. And this is infiltrating the British and the American political elite, such that they're engaged, effectively in Nazi apologism.
Well, when I first met you, David, you were doing a lot of work on Islamic extremism, Islamist terrorism. Now we're also talking about this idea of the Zionist Jewish angle on this. Do you think that is there an attempt here to somehow weaponize religion, to take religion, to maybe to create versions of those religions which will then work against that faith? I mean, this is something I find very curious and fascinating, this link between these Zionist terrorists working with Ukrainian Nazis and these groups like Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, all these groups have been concocted by the CIA beginning in, well, a long time ago, okay, by the British maybe, but in Afghanistan, and then used throughout the last 20-30 years.
So what we see in Ukraine is that the British are supporting the Nazis effectively in Ukraine, and we shouldn't be surprised at that, because of course they have previously supported groups which they otherwise would appear to be opposed to. So, like, for example, the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, and called Nusra, HTS. So the British were on the same side as those organizations in Syria when they supported what they called the moderate armed opposition. actually, the person who was in charge of all of those operations to present the moderate armed opposition as being moderate and not as being allied with ISIS or with Nusra was a woman called Alicia Cairns, who is now the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. She's an MP now, right? So she was working as overseeing a whole load of MI6 contractors involved in Syria. And she's now, of course, quite happy to do the Slava Ukraini on her social media. So that's the standard way in which MI6 operates, right? It will operate with whoever there is there who can take on the enemy, whatever that enemy is, whether it's Colonel Gaddafi, whether it's Bashar al-Assad, or whether it's Vladimir Putin. But of course, when it comes to home, then of course these people who are allies in Syria are very bad people, and we must be opposed to them in all respects. And so that we have to engage in a policy which targets those people, and of course they target those people in a way which is not very selective, and which of course effectively targets all Muslims in the country. So since 9/11, we've seen a ratcheting up of the way in which Muslims in this country in particular are targeted by the state. And that means the creation of a whole series of, well, the retention by the intelligence agencies of a whole series of contractors to present Islam in a certain way, and to try and undermine core tenets of Islam, to reshape, and they say this in their internal documents, reshape British Islam so that it is not, so that Muslims don't support terrorism. But what they're actually doing here is trying to make sure that Muslims don't oppose British foreign policy, which of course is the major thing which is a threat to them. There's no real threat of any significant numbers of Muslims in this country supporting Al-Qaeda or those organizations. There is a threat of significant numbers of Muslims, and there was a threat over Iraq supporting the anti-war movement and left-wing causes, and there was a huge outpouring of dissent over Iraq, and that's part of the reason they've gone into this heavy propaganda to try and split take over elements of the Muslim community through a whole range of different organisations.
Well, it doesn't seem to have happened here, but over in France, we're seeing pictures of film of riots taking place in many of the suburbs in Paris now. It does seem to be spreading and getting worse after this specific individual was shot and killed by a policeman for apparently nothing. That's the sort of thing I would imagine that was... Well, I mean, I know it's talked about by Kees van der Peil in his book, which is looking at all this, is it States of Emergency, I think. I was reading a bit of it the other day. What he's saying is that the elites know that as they take power, as the democracy is slowly squeezed out of the system, as the media is slowly strangulized, and that it becomes a kind of propaganda service, that what's going to happen is people are going to rise up. And this is happening at the moment in France. People have just had enough. They're saying what's happened is that you've got a structural system here where the poor are taxed more than the rich are, and you're actually trying to divide society. That's what they're saying to Macron. Now, this isn't the first problem he's had. He's had the yellow vest. He's had the pension protests. What do you make of these riots that have been taking place in Paris?
Well, I mean, on the question of Islam, I mean, the French have a particular conception of the role of Islam. And it's a much more militant secularism than we have here, because, of course, they got rid of their royal family some time ago through the famous process. So the Islamophobia of the French state is in some ways worse than the Islamophobia of the UK state. But of course, in the UK, it has been very significant that they have there's an organisation which is part of the British intelligence apparatus inside the Home Office called RICU, the Research, Information and Communications Unit, and it's spent most of the last 15 years, I think it is now, it's been in existence, trying to create fake Muslim groups who are in favour of British foreign policy, who are engaged in saying that the Muslims should wear the poppy, or that that extremism is really bad, and which we shouldn't be opposed to British foreign policy. And many of these groups, of course, collaborate with Zionist groups, and indeed many of those are themselves funded by the British government to do this kind of counter-extremism work, by which they mean domesticating the Muslim community, making sure that they don't oppose British foreign policy, and of course part of that is making sure that they don't properly oppose the racist ideology of Zionism as well.
What about this Quran burning we've seen in Stockholm? So, I mean, what do you make of that? Because is it my right to go out into the street here if I wish to, and in fact even invite the press to a press conference where I burn a Bible or burn a Quran?
You mean technically is it legal?
Well, I think it is, but yeah. Why should someone be told this is not a good idea, and should the authorities act in that sort of situation? At the moment, in a weird way, it seems quite a good thing that this is happening in Sweden, because it's stopping their accession to NATO, because the Turks are simply saying, well, if you're going to allow this sort of thing to take place, then you can't be part of NATO. So what's your take on that?
Well, I mean, this is part of an upsurge of Islamophobia we've seen across the whole of Europe, and indeed North America as well, in the last 15 years. And there are a whole network of organisations and groups from the far right. We've seen in this country, of course, the famous Tommy Robinson character, and the various other factions associated with the English Defence League and the organisations which came out of that. And that's part of the same process. These people are all internationally networked. They call themselves the Counter-Jihad Movement. And they want to stage provocations against Muslims in order they can cause trouble. And they can say, look, the Muslims are uncivilized. They don't have our ways. We should get rid of them, etc. So it's a provocation, and we shouldn't fall for that.
No. Martin, what do you make of it? And it's probably going to mean that the NATO conference coming up later this month in Riga is going to, well, they very much wanted Ukraine to be joining NATO. They very much wanted Sweden to be joining NATO. That looks like it won't happen because of something as simple as the burning of a, well, it may not be that simple to many people, the burning of a Quran.
It's not going to be in Riga, it's going to be in Vilnius, but yes.
Sorry, yeah.
Well, I mean, the thing is, somebody burning a Quran is actually quite straightforward to do, isn't it? How many people do you need to do it? And of course, it can cause all kinds of problems and provocate, and it's provocational. And I don't know who's behind it, but you can see it's quite straightforward. You know, you could go out and do it. We could go out and do it now this minute. It wouldn't take much organisation to do it. You could film it, put it up on YouTube, and there it is. The Swedish government no doubt say, well, look, we can't stop them doing it, but we don't necessarily approve. But, of course, that's not going to satisfy the Turks, because, of course, if you tried to do it in Turkey, your feet wouldn't touch the floor. And, of course, in countries like Pakistan, people are constantly being struggling with the idea of blasphemy and so on and so forth. Incidentally, we had Farooq Sadiq on here some weeks ago, did we not, who's Bristol Pakistan Association. Most Bristol Pakistanis are totally uninterested in being extremists, and they're very, very knowledgeable about terrorism in a way that the ordinary population are not. They understand it quite thoroughly. So I think that is a headache for the government. But they're obviously, as you say, they're trying to domesticate them with these kind of, you know, astroturf organisations which are supposedly speaking on behalf of the moderate Muslims. The moderate Muslims were all opposed to invading Iraq. I mean, the success of the cooperation between Stop the War Coalition and the Muslim Council of Great Britain was excellent, and you know, those relationships continue.
Yeah, David, what about this? Because we've had some, I think it was the Grey Zone last week, or maybe even the week before, because we had to miss the show last week, publishing more details about the British role in Gladio. We don't hear a lot about that. The Operation Gladio, which was where the NATO intelligence services were colluding with the far right, mainly in Italy, to create terrorist attacks that were then blamed. Largely, they were blamed on Russian people of Russian influence or the Soviet influence at the time in the 1980s. Is it significant to hear that the Brits were more involved in this Gladio network?
Yes, I mean, it is, especially in the current context where, I mean, we start off with the Ukraine question. And as you were saying, you know, in the period in 2014 after the NATO-backed coup in Ukraine up until the 2022 invasion by the Russians, it was quite possible in the mainstream media to understand and see stuff about there being Nazis in Ukraine. But what I think we now see as they've consolidated their grip inside Ukraine is that we now begin to realise and now begin to remember, if you like, that the Nazis never really went away, which is as the famous song has it, that actually the creation of the West German Intelligence Agency was done by the CIA by employing a guy who had been one of Hitler's high officials. Many of the people who ran NATO later in the period between 1945 and now had been Nazi officials, and there was a concerted effort by the CIA to, rather than to denazify, as was supposed to be the process, to actually protect Nazi officers so that they could use them in intelligence operations. Now, of course, the British were involved in that. And what's striking, I think, is the way in which that has its resonance now. I mentioned the thing you mentioned just a minute ago about the Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. I sent that thing to you the other day, yeah. which indicates that there were Nazi, Ukrainian Nazi youth group meetings of hundreds of people in the UK in the 1960s. Now, I had no idea that was the case. This was after, of course, the Nazis in Ukraine were defeated by the Soviets it took them until 1959 to defeat the Banderites in Ukraine. But in the 60s, there were organizations of Ukrainian nationalists organizing youth camps in the UK, for
so
example.
Who was funding this anti-Bolshevik Nation magazine? I mean, it was quite, you know, reasonably well produced. Who's funding it? Do we know?
I don't know. I mean,
it looks a bit like The Encounter or something like that.
It's a little bit like a kind of a Nazi Encounter, yeah. what I think is striking about this is that I think even me, right? I think I believed that was something of the past, and I'm beginning to see that actually some of that elements of Nazism never really went away, because of course it was used by Western intelligence services, and indeed there are elements of it which survived. They survived in Ukraine, and of course they have elements of survival elsewhere, especially through the intelligence services. And that I think is a revelation to me, anyhow. Maybe I was just naive.
No, I don't think so. I think most of us were sold 20, 30 years through our press that was the end of Nazism. It had been, you know, done away with, Martin, weren't we?
We were, and there's certain levels of cognitive dissonance. We were talking earlier about, you know, Al-Qaeda regarded as an enemy organisation in the propaganda within the Western nations like Britain, but in actual fact, they were set up by the Western intelligence services. They themselves admit it. The story is that they set up Al-Qaeda as a sort of international brigade to fight in Afghanistan, and then they went rogue. But it's just rubbish. Obviously, they still control it now, and I'm quite sure the Russian general staff, the Iranian general staff, Chinese general staff, they know this. The scales have fallen from their eyes. It doesn't surprise me at all that the British were involved in Gladio. That's you know, they are a senior member of the NATO partnership. And, of course, they were keen to setting up Al-Qaeda because of the historic links of Britain to the Muslims in the British Empire, so they were given the lead role on that. The Ukrainian nationalists fled from the Soviet Union at the end of the war, and they were all welcomed with open arms into the West. Loads of them settled in Canada. Krista Friedland, who's the current foreign minister, I think, her grandfather was one of them. And they were immediately weaponized as a means to try and roll back communism in Eastern Europe. So there was actually an armed struggle went on in the Ukraine until the 50s. And then it was crushed. All of this stuff has been there as an undercurrent all along, but it's now coming to a head. And, you know, the kind of Nazism, fascism we're facing now is also, on the other hand, in favour of gay rights and trans rights and so on. And all of this is turning everything, you know, everything is topsy-turvy. It's a kind of looking-glass world where nothing is as it seems. And, you know, coordinating all of this is the intelligence services behind all of this.
I'm glad you brought up LGBT, trans rights, etc. Because I'd love to get Davey's take on this as well. Over the last couple of weeks, I found fascinating little bit of secret recording done by some school kids, 13-year-old school children, at Rye College with one of their teachers, who they took issue with. So let's have a listen to that now. It's about 3 minutes long, and here a teacher is trying to admonish some of her pupils for their apparently bigoted racist attitudes, or bigoted anyway, and homophobic attitudes. And they are very, really quite vociferous in speaking back against her.
How dare you? You just really upset someone. Saying things like, should be in an asylum.
I didn't say that. I just said if they want to identify as a cow or something, then they're like genuinely unwed.
Then they've gone.
Yeah, they're going to be crazy.
You were questioning their identity.
No, I wasn't a question. I was just saying about the gender. I didn't say anything about them.
But where did you get this idea from? There's only two genders.
I just said my opinion. That is my opinion. If I respect their opinion, can't they respect my opinion?
It is not an opinion.
Yes, it is.
It's not an opinion.
There's only two genders. Those people think there's only two genders.
There's only a boy and a girl.
It is today. There's no other private part. There's only two.
Gender is not linked to do with the not linked there to the parts that you were born with. Gender is about how you identify, which is what I said right from the very beginning of the lesson.
I just don't agree with that. So why should I have to listen
biological sex, there is actually three large sets, because you can be born intersex. You can be born with male and female body parts or hormones.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
Yeah, there's three. There's not 300.
Doesn't mean...
Yeah, there's three. I'm talking about biological sex. In terms of gender, there are lots of genders. There is transgender. There is agender. People that don't believe they have a gender at all.
Yeah, but you can't have that.
You can't have that. It's not a law.
It's not a law, but it's our opinion. We just don't agree with it.
If you have a vagina, you're a girl. If you have a penis, you're a woman.
Yeah.
But cisgender is not necessarily the way to be. You were talking about the fact that cisgender is the norm, that you identify with the gender that of the sexual order that you're born with, or you're weird. That's basically what you're saying, which is really despicable.
How? When it's
if I called my mum right now, my mum would feel myself.
If I called my mum, she'd say.
Well, that's very sad as well, then.
How is it?
Those of people agree with that. There's only a small majority of people who actually think that.
And why do you think we have so many problems in the world with homophobia?
Yeah, but that's not homophobia, that's gender.
Yes,
I'm fine with lesbians and gay people.
Same.
I've got nothing against them.
Yeah, same.
But gender is, there is a link between it. And you're saying that people can't change who they want to be.
They can't! Unless you get a penis attached. No, I'm not!
You're confusing sex and gender.
No, I'm not though, because if you have a vagina, you're a girl, if you have a penis, you're a woman.
Yeah, you can't have a vagina and be a girl. But then
unless you get a surgery. Even then, because you've got those genes.
How you identify. How you identify.
Yeah,
but it's not an opinion that we express in this school.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not. And if you don't like it, you need to go to a different school.
So
I'm reporting you to Miss Willis. You need to have a proper educational conversation about equality, diversity and inclusion, because I'm not having that expressed in my lesson. When I'm teaching you about you can be who you want to be, how you identify is up to you.
They just don't say it, because then all this happens.
Maybe because they're polite, maybe they're sensitive.
I haven't said anything in all of the lessons I've been in. It's just because they turned around and started saying something. So I said, how can you identify as a cat when you're a girl?
Well, they're now writing a statement. I would imagine that you'll be asked to write a statement as well.
We will.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah, so there's the 13-year-olds fighting back against their teacher. Martin, their attitude is, look, I mean, actually, we've been sitting listening to this for weeks and months and we're fed up with it. Actually, we don't believe any of it.
Well, I'm just quite poor quality things. I'm trying to follow it and trying to listen to it. I think I've read about this as well. I mean,
it's from Rye College. I think it's East Sussex, somewhere down on the south coast.
Well, at the moment, I believe the government is saying, because the teaching unions and the teachers are asking them, give us some clear guidelines on how we should approach this issue. And the government has said that before the end of term, which is 2 weeks away, they're going to provide guidelines for schools about how to deal with this.
Well, that teacher has already got her guidelines. Well, indeed. She's saying, you have broken the rules, I'm going to report you, and you may have to leave this school.
Yeah. Yes, I heard what was going on there. Well, I mean, there's clearly a huge row debate, whatever you want to call it, about these issues going on. My own views on it are probably not the same as that teacher, but you can see that this is definitely being pushed. There's a definite agenda of people pushing this, but it's not clear what the government's guidelines for teachers are going to be.
There's one basic thing the teacher says.
Because there's no guidelines, teachers are trying to avoid having these conversations.
One basic thing the teacher said there about them being homophobic, they're saying, well, I've got nothing against lesbians and gays. I just think it's ridiculous for people just to be able to identify as various different sexes, some of which don't exist.
Well, I think this is the issue, isn't it? Can you just completely erase the idea of biological sex and put it under the term gender? I think that a lot of what we think of as male or female characteristics is cultural. You know, the Romans wouldn't wear trousers because they thought they were effeminate, but there you go, that was the Romans. But of course, I think underlying all of this stuff is an attempt to bog us all down in discussing irrelevancies. We're about to have a potential nuclear
irrelevant.
War.
Martin, it's not irrelevant for those kids, is it? Because they are potentially facing being expelled from the school.
Yeah, but I mean, schools do expel kids for all sorts of things all the time. I mean, we do get kids who are, in fact, homophobic, racist, and so on. We deal with it all the time.
I mean, that teacher would probably be
saying those kids are.
That teacher would probably be convinced that it's hate speech and that these kids.
Well, I mean,
must
I think that when she used the word despicable, I don't think that was helpful. Mm. She's not engaging them, is it? She wants to engage. I mean, and they don't necessarily have to agree with her either, do they? Surely we can have a debate about this.
Anyway,
we can
David,
disagree about
a sociologist, let's bring you in, David, on this. What do you make of this whole LGBT plus movement?
Well, I mean, the way in which it has been co-opted, the LGBT movement, the lesbian and gay movement, let's put it like that, it's been co-opted by power is, I think, the most extraordinary element of it. I mean, I saw something just the other day in Munich, the Pride demonstration there. There was a performance of a band right song at Pride. Now, that's kind of a bit jarring. But, you know, GCHQ, the British Signals Intelligence Agency, of course, has lit itself up in the Pride flag. And what's been happening is that not just the kind of the commercialisation of Pride and of the lesbian and gay movement, but also of its use by imperialism in penetrating non-Western countries. And I use the word penetrating advisedly, you know, whether there's an attempt to try and foment revolutions in countries which are not seen as being friendly to the West. And of course, that's at the forefront of that is our liberal values of one sort or another. They use feminism to some extent, they use the lesbian and gay movement, and of course they use all sorts of other issues like hate speech and freedom of speech as means to pursue colour, what are called colour revolutions. They did it in Eastern Europe, they did it in Ukraine in 2004, and of course they've tried to do it in a whole number of other countries. And that's, of course, what the British intelligence and the US intelligence agencies are up to. That's what the National Endowment for Democracy is for. That's why they fund all sorts of journalistic activities to try and subvert and undermine state power in states which are not friendly to the West. And that, so that seems to me to be a problematic issue, and it's something which we in this country have to start to understand. And I think I would say the final thing I would say about it is that you know, people in the West ought to understand that liberal ideas are not necessarily the only ideas in the world and not necessarily the best ideas in the world, and that people in other countries have other ways of understanding the world, which are not necessarily inferior to Western liberalism. Western liberalism is a particular sort of politics and a particular sort of ideology. People in the left have always rejected Western liberalism. But, you know, we don't have in the end to say all of the countries outside the West have views on gender or on sexuality or on religion which are inferior to those in the West, because Western ideology is itself linked to power and linked to interest. And so we shouldn't be scared, I think, of being critical of liberalism.
Well, earlier this week, 12 people were killed in a Kramatorsk restaurant by a missile attack by the Russians. Certainly it was being pitched here in the West as just innocent people having a spot to eat in a restaurant in Kramatorsk. And the Russian side, if you have a look at that, what they're saying is that they believe that there were a whole bunch of NATO officers in there, Martin, having a chat with people from the Ukrainian army and having a bit of a meal with them. What do you make of this attack, David? Maybe you first. What do you make of this sort of, what we've got here is it's being pitched into the Western public as an atrocity.
So it would appear that civilians did die in the attack, but it's also pretty clear that there were military in there. And whether that makes it a legitimate target or not, it probably doesn't. But it does seem clear that there were people with all sorts of military attire and logos, which has been clear from the videos which have come out, and audio from the scene with them trying to dig out people in military uniforms. So, we see the latest in a long line of stories from Ukraine, which is. Doesn't live up to its initial billing in the West. And it turns out when you look at the full facts that there's something else going on.
What do you make of Kramatorsk, Martin?
Well, I think it's interesting that Zelensky is saying that they've got a traitor who fingered the restaurant. Now, if it's a random attack on a civilian restaurant, you don't need somebody to finger it to be attacked. I think what it is, it's actually, the restaurant is not on the street, it's in a hotel. So basically what you've got is the hotel is full of Western mercenaries.
Can we just have a listen to yesterday's BBC news report on the attack? This is the BBC, by the way.
The Ukrainian president says a man accused of helping Russia with this week's deadly attack on the city of Kramatorsk will be charged with treason. Volodymyr Zelensky said those working with Russia to destroy lives deserve the maximum penalty. 12 people were killed in the missile strike on a busy restaurant. 4 people from the UK were among more than 60 others who were wounded. From Kiev, our security correspondent Gordon Carrera reports.
The Ukrainian security service says that on Tuesday the suspect had been instructed to find out whether the restaurant was open and who was there. They claim the man, an unnamed local who'd been recruited by Russian military intelligence before last year's invasion, then covertly filmed the pizzeria and the cars parked nearby before sending the footage to his handlers. Russia claims it does not target civilians, but the missile struck the restaurant at 7:30 that night. The victims included 3 teenagers and also one 32-year-old American man. 12 foreign citizens, including 4 from the UK, were among those injured. President Zelensky said the alleged spotter for the Russians would be charged with treason and could face life imprisonment. On the same day as the missile strike in Kramatorsk, another man was sentenced to 10 years in prison for passing on details of the position of Ukrainian troops, artillery and logistics routes to Moscow.
So that's the BBC news report on it. It certainly doesn't sound like some sort of random attack, especially if they were military. We hear there 4 people from the UK were caught in the attack. Well, they are potentially British military officers.
Well, or lower ranks, possibly. I don't know. This is a deliberate attack on the restaurant, it seems to me, and it's a deliberate attack on what they saw as, you know, if you remember at the beginning of the crisis, a load of mercenaries were bust into Lviv, and they got them all settled down in a hotel. they'd only just arrived in the Ukraine, and the Russians waited till they were all settled in, and then they hit their hotel with a missile and killed them all. Because they're not going to wait for them to turn up on the front line to be playing Call of Duty. If you turn up to the Ukraine to fight, we're going to kill you. And the Russians have made that absolutely clear. British mercenaries are very heavily involved in the Ukraine. The British Special Forces are definitely involved. They've admitted that several, you know, scores of SAS are out there. And there's only 400 of them in total. And a lot of the attacks on the Kerch Bridge, which killed three civilians, remember? Yeah, three civilians were killed in the attack on the Kerch Bridge. That was the British. The assassination of Zakarchenko, the Prime Minister of Donbass Republic in 2017, bombing his office, that's got the fingerprints of British Special Forces all over it, to my mind. And they are advising the Ukrainians, even if they're not directly involved.
So it's the idea, David, you think, that simply the more the NATO people from the NATO countries in Ukraine that we kill, the less likely they are to enthusiastically join the fight?
From the Russians' point of view?
Yeah.
Well, I think that the Russians are, you know, are steadily taking the gloves off as NATO escalates. Then the Russians are saying, well, you know, if you're going to start trying to bomb the Kremlin, if you're going to send people into Belgorod, then we're going to take direct action against the equipment coming in and indeed the people coming in. It's clear, perfectly clear that there are Western mercenaries there. I mean, actually, it's perfectly clear that very senior British intelligence and military figures are directly advising and have been directly advising the Ukrainians since 2014. So, you know, it's not really a surprise that this would happen. When you look at the footage of the restaurant, I mean, when there was a mention of the cars outside, well, the cars outside are military vehicles, and you can see that from the footage. These are not vehicles that have rocked up after the explosion. These were vehicles which were covered in dirt and grime from the explosion. So from the Russian point of view, yes, it was a military target, but, you know, of course, it appears that civilians have been killed in it.
Can I just say this thing about civilians? If you go to a restaurant full of military personnel, then you might end up dead. And, of course, this is the sort of thing the IRA used to do as well. If you don't hang around close to military people, don't talk to them, don't have anything to do with them, because we're going to kill them. And if you're in the way as well, yeah, you're going to be killed as well. And the British have killed millions of people in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya in the last 20 yeah. years alone.
This is collateral damage of various
sorts.
That's
right. Yeah. When we were dropping bombs all over Iraq, I mean, plenty of babies were burned.
If you think about the drones hitting wedding parties, funerals, this sort of thing.
That's right.
Pretty horrific toll on the civilian population. Anyway, finally, David, we've got to talk about, well, actually, no, finally we'll be talking a little bit about your fighting fund, but what about this coup on Saturday, the 24-hour coup, supposed coup anyway? I was quite amused to hear the frantic sounds of the British press all the way through Saturday talking about how Putin was about to be toppled, overthrown. This was the worst day for him ever. The whole of the Russian state was starting to crumble as Wagner turned in on them. But anyway, at the end of the day, apparently it's all settled. Doesn't sound like the ordinary kind of coup to me.
Well, I mean, the Prigozhin had a little chat with Lukashenko. He said, mate, you want to come to Minsk and hang out here for a while? And Prigozhin says, yeah, that'll be fine. We don't want to cause any mayhem or any murder. So, I mean, I think the key questions really are, was this a real thing, or was it a Russian psyop? Now, at the beginning, I was leaning much more towards a Russian psyop, that both Putin and Prigozhin were just acting. I mean, it's, you know, it looks like that's what Prigozhin has been doing.
That means telling the Western press what they wanted to
hear. Yeah. So it looks like that's what Prigozhin was doing before. Because if you remember when Artemovsk, or Bakhmut, as it's called in Ukraine, was about to fall, and Prigozhin was saying, these in the Russian Ministry of Defense, they're not giving us any artillery or weapons. We can't fight. We're losing tons of men. This is terrible. That appears, in retrospect, to have been a psyop, that they were, you know, just playing. But, you know, this now possibly looks like Prigozhin is is a little bit of a feisty character, and perhaps he was doing something serious. But in either case, there was no threat to Putin, and there is no threat to Putin inside Russia. He is overwhelmingly popular, 80% approval ratings.
What about these Wagner troops and the tanks on the streets in the Russian cities? I mean, is that's not pretend.
Nothing happened. Well, it wasn't pretend. The tanks were there, but nothing happened. I mean, you know, I mean, what was the most interesting thing that happened, which appears to be the most violence that happened during the whole period, was that there were civilians on the streets in Rostov who were fighting each other about whether they supported the Wagner or they supported the Russian Minister of Defence. So, I mean, that seems to have been the highlight of the event.
What you're saying is that it could be that that all these troops just went into the cities for a bit of rest and recuperation, and the whole thing was then spun into something completely different.
Well, it's said, I mean, who knows, but it's said that that many of them were kind of suckered into it, didn't really realise what they were doing, and then some of them weren't very happy about it. I don't know.
Martin?
Well, obviously, I've been reading lots and lots of different interpretations of this. I think the real question to ask is, was Prigozhin in any way working with the SBU or with the West? Because he certainly, there's some evidence that he had some contact with the Ukrainian intelligence services when he went the last time to Africa. I've never been a big fan of Prigozhin. I mean, you just think, well, what the hell's he doing?
I mean,
there?
The obvious thing is, you know, it's a mercenary army.
The obvious thing on
Saturday morning is maybe somebody has offered him more money. This is a mercenary army for.
They're not really a mercenary army. They get their weapons and they get their bullets from the Russian Ministry of Defence. At least, you know, so that's another reason to think that there's nothing real about some of it.
Well, I mean, some people think that this was all a spun, but you know, a Russian psyop. I tend not to think so because it hasn't done them much good. It hasn't done them much harm either, because in actual fact, it's just shown how weak anybody who wanted to stand up to the government of Russia. And let's not personalise it as Putin, because the target of Prigozhin's expletive laced rants was Shoigu and Gerasimov.
Yeah.
And he didn't, and he kept Putin out of it. The other thing about it is that the fundamental thing that's been going on is there's more than one private military company in Russia. Wagner's the biggest one, but there's lots of other ones. And they're all being reorganised to be put under the direct control of the Ministry of Defence. Now, that means an end to Prigozhin's gravy train. Yeah?
Yeah.
And that's exactly why he's basically a gangster oligarch of the old school. He's a product of the Yeltsin era. Could you compare him to
Eric Prince? You know, the
Eric Prince has got some military background. Prigozhin hasn't. He's just a gangster.
He's a chef, right?
Well, he says he's a chef, but I mean, in actual fact,
but he also ran the Internet Research Agency, which is
I would never have trusted him as far as I could spit, frankly. And this is the problem. I mean, Moon of Alabama, Bernhardt, who's a German guy who runs that, he just made a big quote from Machiavelli about the problem with mercenaries. Mm. The problem with mercenaries is they fight for money. And if somebody offers them more money, they change sides. Now, I don't think that's true. They're not mercenary in that sense, as you say. Yeah. Just like the private military companies that are spun off the British Army don't go out shooting British soldiers. Because it's a way of having stuff you can do where, for example, loads of Wagner people were killed in Syria, and if there'd been Russian regular forces, the mums would have been saying, this is outrageous, why are our boys dying in Syria? But if it's a load of ex-cons working for Wagner, there's not so much of a fuss, which is exactly why they use private military companies in Afghanistan. The West does.
I mean, it's certainly the case, though, that the Russians didn't regard it as a serious threat which they should engage. I mean, if you saw the footage of the operation to block the main highways into Moscow, they put lorries across them, they took the keys, or they dug little holes.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Wagner comes along and just pushes the lorries away. And, of course, there's no military there to shoot at them or stop them or anything.
Well, I think the policy has been to try and get it sorted as quickly as possible with the minimum amount of bloodshed, which is admirable. But, of course, one of the problems is, what I understand, is that they didn't realise that Wagner had Pantsir missiles on the convoy that was going from Rostov to Moscow. And various Russian helicopters flew out, buzzed them, and they shot them down, which killed several pilots. Now, if the Russian Air Force are going to be pretty fed up with that, and they're going to demand that the people who shot our people, killed our people, will have to face punishment.
So, David, what's your take on where things are heading with this Ukraine war?
Well, I mean, we have seen the much vaunted attempt by the Ukrainians to fight back. They were going to launch this in the spring, and they've eventually now launched it. They seem to have taken some territory, have been allowed by the Russians, I think, into fire traps, and then they've been pushed back within hours in almost every case, I think. So it's a massively unsuccessful counterattack, and the result of it has been that a huge number of Western, newly delivered Western military equipment has just ended up as scrap, including the much vaunted German Leopard tanks, the American fighting vehicles, Bradley fighting vehicles, etc. So it's been a way for the Russians to destroy what is it, the third or the fourth army now that's been thrown against them since the beginning of the special military operation. And as a result, you know, we see the Russians are in full control, really. And the question really is, what is their game plan? They currently control almost all of four oblasts or districts in Ukraine, the two Donbass districts and two others. What are they going to stop there, or are they going to take another four and up to Kiev, or even more than that? That's the question, I think, which is outstanding.
Well, that question might be answered if the United States is close on approving the ATACMS for Ukraine, which is another missile system. They seem to be sitting there watching and wondering, well, if the missiles become longer range, well, we have to just keep going. And this seems to be maybe the NATO game plan, is every time the Russians move forward and start to slow down, then they introduce a new missile system for the Ukrainians.
Yeah, I mean, it's a step-by-step escalation, isn't it? A year ago, Biden was saying that under no circumstances would they get tanks or particular missiles or helicopters or F-16s, but now that all of this is now cleared to be supplied.
Well, the Army Tactical Missile Systems, just looking them up here, have a range of up to 190 miles. That's potentially going to force the Russians to advance further, Martin.
Well, that's what, Lavrov said, you know, the more you introduce these things in, the more we'll have to push you back just to make sure you can't, because they were shelling indiscriminately into the Donbass for years.
Yeah.
So we're talking about this Kramatorsk restaurant thing. That's a precision hit compared to what they would do.
I mean, there's a lot of talk recently over Russian nuclear weapons starting to be deployed out in Belarus. We've had from the Grey Zone, Max Blumenthal yesterday, a report of him speaking actually down at the UN Security Council. I don't often see him down there. He's a bit like Roger Waters going down and speaking there. What about Max telling the UN Security Council, why are we tempting nuclear annihilation? Because it does seem to be a kind of fear factor here. It's extremely risky strategy for the West, to even if it is a lose scenario, they've got no intention of actually winning. We're getting far closer towards the potential of a nuclear exchange of some kind than we've had even during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely worrying. I mean, the problem with the people who run NATO is that they have no analysis of the Russians. They don't have any proper understanding of the Russians. I mean, people who are in charge of this kind of stuff, people like Chris Donnelly, the guy who used to be an advisor to the Secretary General of NATO a long time ago and ran this thing called the Institute for Statecraft and was involved in the Kerch Bridge plan to blow up the Kerch Bridge. You know, he's military intelligence. And, you know, of course, the term military intelligence is itself an oxymoron. And this is a guy who has entertains mad fantasies about who the Russians are and what threat kind of threat they are, and these are the kind of people who will be suggesting to NATO, well, we might need to escalate, and these people, you know, this is Dr. Strangelove territory. They would escalate to the point of a nuclear war.
I mean, they're trying to get inside their heads. It's not a pleasant place to be, but is it? Do you think that they are simply too proud to admit that they've made a mess of all this, and that they're going to lose, and so they're kind of doubling down on what is essentially a stupid failed decision in the first place?
They are doubling down. I mean, what's interesting about this whole period, I think, is that many of the best critiques of NATO strategy in the West are coming from people on the right, ex-military people, ex-intelligence people, McGregor, Scott Ritter, even Jeffrey Sachs, for God's sakes, John Mearsheimer, and these are all people who are not leftists, with a possible small exception for Jeffrey Sachs, but who are on the right and who are criticising liberals and those who are in favour of escalation in Ukraine, and you know, it's an extraordinary position where on the left and amongst liberals in this country that most people are in favour of standing with Ukraine, whatever that means. Whereas in America, there's all sorts of right-wingers who are giving a much better account of what's actually going on.
Well, I'm rather pleased to see that at least the UK Stop the War Coalition, which I think is John Rees, Lindsay German, the Communist Party of Britain or something, basically, and they've now taken down this demand from the British Stop the War Coalition that the Russians withdraw from Ukraine. Partly, I suppose, because it's very difficult to actually explain what Ukraine is now. It's a very much a disputed word and a disputed border. But anyway, you're fighting fund, David.
Yes, okay. So I, as you mentioned before, I was sacked by the University of Bristol in October 2021. And then I went through an appeal process at the university, which, of course, was unsuccessful. And I now am shaping up for a battle with the university at an industrial tribunal starting on the 16th of October in Bristol, which will last 2 weeks. And of course, I have to raise funds for my legal team for that, which is a little bit expensive. And so I have a fighting fund appeal to ask people to contribute towards my legal costs. And of course, what I'm fighting for is that people shouldn't be sacked for having political views on Israel, and indeed that they should be able to have the academic freedom to research and publish on questions of Israel and Zionism and Islamophobia, which the university has clearly not allowed me to do. So I would say that what I'm fighting for is academic freedom and for the ability of people in the future to advance anti-Zionist ideas and beliefs, and as a result for them not to be sacked. So I would ask for people to support the appeal, which is at fightingfund.org, and you can donate money there in a variety of ways.
Is it electronic or is cash allowed?
Cash is allowed. Yes. Very kind. Thank you.
Okay, Martin, this struggle that David's been involved in, academic freedom, this is quite a serious form of cancellation. We've seen cancellation in politics in all sorts of areas at the moment, aren't we?
Yeah, I just read an article in the London Review of Books not long ago by Srivanasan, I think it is, about this whole issue of academic freedom, because it's being presented, because we've now got the czar that's been appointed by the government to insist on free speech in universities, which is actually more to do with silencing people they disagree with. So you can see the kind of Orwellian world we now live in, where people who are trying to silence other people complain that they themselves are being silenced and that they've got to force universities to follow their own rules about freedom of speech. And of course, there's a big difference between freedom of speech and academic freedom, which is the article covers. Because if you're an academic, you don't just get to say anything. There's all this sort of peer review and all the rest of it. And they're saying, well, there aren't enough climate change deniers in the universities. I said, well, that's because it's all peer reviewed. You know, you're allowed to have a view that you don't like climate change, but you can't be the climate change professor, because you can't, because there's a whole process by which, you know, an academic freedom isn't just the freedom to say anything you want. If you want it, you know, you've got to, it's all got to be properly looked into.
On this, Is this just a kind of side effect of privatisation of universities and the gradual creeping privatisation?
I mean, the privatisation, marketisation of the universities, of course, makes it much more difficult to pursue evidence-based research, especially when that evidence-based research might challenge ideas that powerful institutions don't want challenged. So, and when I say powerful institutions, I mean both the corporations and the state. So, yes, it's difficult. And, of course, the response to that by the corporations and the state, and the way in which the marketisation enables
that. These are the people funding many of our universities.
Is that they have increasingly started to fund the universities. So there's much more corporate money now funding research, which of course means that the research won't be proper science. And indeed, the intelligence services themselves are funding university departments and grants all over the place. It's extraordinary.
Well, and also whole blocks being built on the side of university buildings being funded by private companies. I don't know if that's until anyway. Where's the best place for people to follow you online? Your blog. I know Spinwatch is one place that you can keep an eye on stuff you're up to, David. But Twitter, where are your various socials?
On Twitter, I'm tracking_power, and I also edit the website powerbase.info. And the site for donating to the appeal is fightingfund.org.
Professor David Miller. Well, actually, no longer professor. Am I right? You're a doctor, but no longer a professor because you're not at the university. Is that right?
I think so.
Okay. David Miller, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Let us pray. Accept our praise and thanksgiving, O God, Creator and Redeemer of all, and inspire us to open our hearts to receive the blessing of your love, that we may serve you through our words, our actions, and our attitudes, and that in the fullness of time we may know the joy of your peace. Through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen. We continue to hold in prayer the community of this college, especially praying today for our college nurse and for all who teach, study and research in history and politics. As this academic year comes to an end, we give thanks for all that has been noble and lovely and true in our life together, and ask God mercy and forgiveness for our shortcomings. In the wider church, we pray for our college livings in the Richmond team ministry, for the church wardens and people of St. Mary Magdalene, St. Matthias and St. John the Divine, and for Wilma, the team rector, Mary, team vicar, and Joe, who is shortly to join the clergy team. We pray that these churches might be places of deep fellowship, engaged service, and effective mission. Through the same Jesus Christ, our Lord.
Amen.
Our final prayer continues the theme of the second psalm at this evening's service. O God, the King of old, look upon the trouble that faces your people today. So much that we have built up has been destroyed. So much that we value is derided. So much that speaks to us of your love and power is mocked. We fear the arrogance of those who oppose all that our faith means to us, and tremble as we see the forces of chaos and anarchy gather and swell. O God, the King of old, hear our prayer above the roar of the chaos, and by your abiding mercy, return us to the peace of your calm, the beauty of true worship, and the confidence of strong faith. Through the same Jesus Christ, our Lord.
Amen.
And we say the grace together. The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, and the love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit, be with us all, evermore. Amen.
1975. That is the Stylistics. I Can't Give You Anything. Before that, we heard a prayer of some kind, quite a good one, I thought, actually, this week. And before it, All Things Bright and Beautiful, but not the normal hymn. It's the John Rutter version. And so, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Just discussing during the break there a few things to do with the Saturday's coup. Martin, you were saying that the there was actually some live fire, which I hadn't seen, where a helicopter or helicopters were shot down by the Wagner Group.
Well, I've obviously been reading a lot about this, and one of the things that has been said, and I can't, you know, people have to do their own research, is that the Wagner Group had actually anti-aircraft Pantsir missiles with them as they were moving towards Moscow. They were buzzed by Russian mainstream army helicopters, and some of those helicopters were shot down with loss of life. And that, of course, if it is true, and people need to check this because there's lots of rumours swirling around, does make what they've done more reprehensible in the eyes of the Russian public. But I think what's clearly happened is even those who are kind of pro-Wagner in their rows with the defence ministry simply cannot support what they've done. And as Putin said, this is a stab in the back at a crucial moment, and it's unforgivable. And that's the general
view.
Will
we be hearing from Prigozhin Wagner at all again, do you think?
Well, he may turn.
Obviously, they're still. They haven't gone away yet.
Yes, well, he was being bigged up in the Western media as a potential ruler of Russia that we can do business with. So it may be, if he manages to get to the West, they will try and, tart him up as a potential alternative to Putin, which is ludicrous. Ludicrous, because he's simply, you know, what people were thinking, he was going to run in the presidential election next year in Russia. But that's why they thought he was making all these noises.
This is another going to be another Alexei Navalny, is he?
Well, maybe.
One of these Western people, they say.
What may happen is he may just have to stay in Belarus because Lukashenko, he's under Lukashenko's protection, but he'll just have to keep quiet and keep his head down because I'm quite sure some elements within the Russian security forces will want him dead.
Not on Navalny then.
No. Navalny was more, Prigozhin is vociferously anti-West, although he was saying in some of his video rants that the whole war should never have happened, that there was no reason for it, etc., which does make me ring alarm bells that in actual fact he is working directly or indirectly as a double agent for Western intelligence.
Okay, well, services. I'm not banging on about Navalny for no reason at all, because we had at Glastonbury last weekend, what we had, goodness me, was the Alexei Navalny Foundation speaking on behalf of pro net zero, which I find bizarre. Who is this Navalny character, and why has he got a foundation which is apparently pro net zero and part of Extinction Rebellion?
Well, I mean, the other thing that happened at Glastonbury is they wouldn't show the Jeremy Corbyn film about how he was, the plot against Corbyn.
Yeah, I think the whole thing went a bit funny, didn't it? I think it was about 2002. We had the BBC turn up and started doing live coverage of Glastonbury, and also the Mean Fiddler took over the security. And, I mean, you and I, did you go to Glastonbury in the old days?
I've never been to Glastonbury.
Never? Okay, well, the 1980s, a couple of times, I think maybe once in the early 90s too. But the turn of the century has seen a complete, I think, change in the whole cultural character of Glastonbury. And so, you know, this is the sort of person we've got, Alexei Navalny's Foundation turning up to lecture us about the environment. Amazing, really. But Navalny is actually very friendly, apparently, with, if you believe Marvin Rees, our mayor of Bristol. He said, when my pal next Alexei Navalny is free, I'm going to give him a grand tour of Bristol. Apparently, they're both Yale World Fellows. So what is this whole system of Yale World Fellows that people like Navalny, who is touted in the West as one of the great opposition leaders in Russia, and Marvin Rees have in common, Martin?
Well, I mean, the Yale Fellows that you're talking about, I presume what it is they get, up-and-coming type people from all over the world, and they give them a free year at Harvard or Yale or whatever it is, and these people then become, suborned by the U.S. state, effectively, directly and indirectly. That's what that's all about. And but what's happened...
Well, one film, you were talking about Jeremy Corbyn, but one film that is getting its premiere at Glastonbury is the... not the Big Lie film about Jeremy Corbyn, but it is the film Navalny from Russia. Maria Pevchich, who runs Navalny International, and the Glastonbury programme announced her as a player in post-Putin Russia. And apparently Odessa Rhea is producer of the award-winning Navalny film, which will have its Glastonbury premiere. So, I mean, it's a whole sort of operation here, it seems, connected with Western intelligence, which is pretending to represent Russia at Glastonbury.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Western intelligence services, if you remember back in the 1950s, they funded... in an underhand way, abstract expressionist art.
Yeah, that was what we were talking about, Encounter magazine.
Yeah,
earlier.
That's right. So the other what they do is they also cognitively infiltrate the rebellious young people at Glastonbury and fill their mind. You know, there's quite a conscious policy of feeding them disinformation. And it's quite easy for people at Glastonbury who don't know much about Russian life or politics to think, oh yes, Putin's an evil guy, he invaded Ukraine just like Blair invaded Iraq, and we're opposed. They are being manipulated, basically. That's what's going on. And and you know, Pussy Riot turned up, and you know, they were taken around Glastonbury by not this year, but in a previous year by Billy Bragg. Now, I dare anybody to hum me a Pussy Riot song. I know loads and loads. You know, I can sing "God Save the Queen" by the Sex Pistols, "White Man in Hammersmith Palais" by the Clash, "Town Called Malice" by the Jam. I can't think of any song by Pussy Riot because they're basically a conflation, yeah, a created thing to make Western young people feel that they can, oh yes, Pussy Riot, they're against Putin and all.
Well,
the rest
this
of
is
it.
One of the things I'd just like to mention to do with the Better Way conference a few weeks ago over in Bath, which I recorded. And one chap I've recorded called Philip Ridley, and you can have a listen to this, it's just a couple of minutes. He's extremely interesting, very plausible, but right at the end of it, and reading through his literature, it seems that he doesn't actually believe in viruses at all. They don't apparently exist. He's got quite a well-funded foundation. And he's obviously, they've got their own journal and this sort of thing, very professional looking, but apparently no such thing as a virus. Anyway, he doesn't mention that here, but I only found that out after I spoke to him. So I'll put a full version of this interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later.
So I'm Philip Ridley. I'm from the Weston A. Price Foundation, and we support the works of Dr. Weston A. Price, who was the preeminent dentist in the 1930s, travelled the world to see why isolated tribes had perfect teeth and health. And what he found was the opposite of the World Health Organization's dietary guidelines. It wasn't the low-fat, high-carbohydrate food pyramid that we adopted in 1984 in England. It was what he found was that the isolated tribes, when he tested the food, it had 10 times more fat-soluble vitamins, A, D, and K2, which is in the very cholesterol-rich foods that we're told not to eat today.
Amazing. Well, what happened in 1984 then?
We adopted the World Health Organization's dietary guidelines, and that reversed what we'd done ever since World War II in response to Spanish flu, where it was established at that point that it was vitamin D deficiency. And the recommendation there was have more sunshine, have more full-fat dairy, meat and fish. And then the World Health Organization come in and say, actually, the problem is excesses of modernity. It's very a Marxist position. But the interesting thing is that the very same year that we adopted that low-fat diet, which was designed to counter pandemics and rickets, etc., the very same year we adopted the 1984 Public Health Act, which is what was utilised to lock us down. And the British government will have known that if the public become vitamin D deficient, we'd see a repeat of what we saw with Spanish flu.
So what was in the Public Health Act?
The Public Health Act provided a power to ministers to put in health regulations without getting a vote in Parliament first. So a lot of the regulations cited the Public Health Act as their authority for the statutory instruments that locked us down.
So that's Philip Ridley there speaking to me at the Better Way Conference in Bath, which is a health conference organised by Dr. Tess Lawry and the World Council for Health, which attempts anyway to be a replacement for the World Health Organization. Now, Martin, quite a lot of interesting points he's making, but also some, it seems, sort of fundamental factual errors too.
Well, I mean, the idea that the use of the word Marxist as a negative there tends to suggest the sort of mentality underlying all of this. That's a bit of a giveaway. The other thing about Spanish flu was created by the Rockefeller Foundation using they were sending the American doughboys over to fight in World War One. One of the main problems in trench warfare is that people got flu, and then they were ineffective, they couldn't fight. So what they do is they developed an anti-flu vaccine, which was developed from horses. And then they gave all of the US Army, or many of them, this anti-flu vaccine, and it turned out to give them a deadly version of flu, Spanish flu. So, and the Spanish flu actually killed...
Which then was contagious.
Yes, and of course it was contagious, and of course it then led to bacteriological infections which actually killed people. So it strikes me that this person simply don't know that history. It's not to do with vitamin D deficiency. It's almost like the
he was saying
holistic
that
health gone mad.
That actually it wasn't to do with vitamin D deficiency. I was a bit confused.
Well, yeah,
there.
But I mean the point is that this is the kind of holistic health... And I'm not opposed to the ideas of holistic health, but carried to an extreme where you're basically refusing to face the fact that this was probably a and I believe, of course, that COVID-19 itself was another created virus for a specific purpose.
The point I'm making is, and I started off with the control group a few weeks ago who were, I thought, excellent, the idea of taking control of your actual health information rather than allowing it to be far off to and sold off to insurance companies, private health organisations, that sort of thing. They were brilliant, but I'm afraid he didn't really quite pass the test there. Also, someone I spoke to recently was Jackie Devoy. She's been involved in she's made, I think, an excellent film about midazolam and the abuse of this drug, which is also used on death row to kill people in end-of-life care. And so here's a little extract from the interview with her about her film A Good Death, where she talks about her father's death and also eugenics.
I mean, a lot of them have made no secret of the fact that they're the Malthusian eugenicists, you know, and that they're keen to depopulate. You know, Boris Johnson and his father, Stanley Johnson, have spoken openly about it, you know. They all believe that the world is overpopulated and that depopulation is the way forward. But they can't go out shooting people. So they're doing it in a more subtle way, and they're coming at us from all angles, you know. They're increasing... they're increasing the deaths of the elderly in the way I've just described. They're also, people are dying younger, even though a lot of people think we're dying older, because of medications, a lot of iatrogenic death going on. There are more people having terminations. There are more people, the more stillbirths. And all the medications and these things that they're bringing in, such as these mRNA injections under the guise of vaccines, which people are willingly taking, although they did have to be bullied quite a lot this time, they're still ultimately killing themselves, you know. So the governments aren't having to go out and actually do the dirty work. They just brainwash the people into killing themselves.
To be fair, a lot of people, I mean, these boosters are going down like a lead balloon, aren't they?
Yeah, a lot of people have just kind of woken up, say, hang on, I've had five now and I don't want another one, you know, this can't be. And a lot of people are very, very ill from it now. Even I've noticed changes in people who've had the jabs who aren't ill as such. But one thing I've noticed is the ones who are saying, oh, I'm fine, I've had the jabs and I'm fine, they've aged. They look older. They've aged 10 years in the last three, you know, last two
years.
Well,
I was in a taxi the other day, and the taxi driver was saying to me, he said, I wish I had never had the... He said, my health has just been slowly declining since I had the second jab, and I wish I'd never had it. And I said, well, you can't de-inject this stuff. That's the problem. You know, it's a one-way decision. And I can remember, actually, as a kid, having the TB BCG at school.
Yeah, I remember. We that's the last one I had, I think. I mean, people in my group have taken separate routes. The sad thing was, while I was making the film, my dad was killed by a paramedic in his own bed at home. He'd had a bit of a breathing issue with his... my dad used to have problems with swallowing and stuff sometimes, and sometimes he'd eat too fast and choke on his toast. So I think, I don't know what happened to him that morning, I wasn't there. But an ambulance was called, and the paramedics spoke to me on the phone. I was next of kin, had power of attorney. I said, I'm on my way. I'll be an hour. Don't give him anything. Don't inject him with anything, because I knew what they see an old man in the bed. It's like, okay, let's get rid of him. There were three very young paramedics in their 20s. And I said, do not inject him with anything. Do not give him midazolam. Do not give him morphine. He's not in any pain. He doesn't need those drugs. And don't inject him with anything until I get there and see him. They knew I was driving up the motorway. Halfway up the motorway, I got a phone call from my daughter saying that he was dead. I spoke to the paramedics and I said, what's happened? What have you done? What have you given my dad? And they said, we haven't given him anything. I said, you've given him something, because he was fine and now he's dead. What's happened? And they lied and said they hadn't given him anything. My dad's carer overheard them talking about midazolam and what dose they were going to give him. They swore blind they hadn't given him that. When I got the ambulance report, they'd given him an injection, apparently, of glycopyrrolidinium bromide, which is the drug that stops death rattle. It's reduces any secretions in the throat, basically. I told them not to inject him with anything, and they injected him with that. I think if that's what they gave him, he had a fatal reaction, because he was dead within half an hour, and he died in a really horrible, undignified way. And I went to the police. I basically said, my dad's been, something happened. He was alive 1 minute, dead the next. I think he's some kind of, misadventure on the part of the, or malpractice on the part of the paramedics. The girl who injected him was 21 years old. I looked her up on social media. I know exactly who she is. I haven't contacted her, obviously. I thought, I'll go down an official route. I went to the police. A lot of people have gone to the police, get absolutely nowhere.
Yeah.
When the police realise what you're suggesting, so after 8 months, the police contacted me and said, we're closing the case. And I said, why? They said, well, we've been down all avenues of investigation. I said, you haven't investigated at all. Mm. You haven't spoken to any of the witnesses. And they said, well, there weren't any witnesses, really, apart from the paramedics, because the paramedics had asked the other people to stand outside the door when they did what they had to do. And my dad's carer knew he'd been injected, because she said when she went back into the room, he had his arm out over the covers, had previously been under the covers, and he had his sleeve rolled up to his shoulder. So she said, and I said to her at that point, check all the bins after the paramedics had left. I said, and they'd taken my dad's body away. She found a syringe wrapper in one of the bins, so which proves a syringe had been taken out of a wrapper. That's all.
Good God.
So that's Jackie Devoy there speaking to me a few weeks ago. Martin, I mean, it's a very difficult thing to accuse paramedics of murdering your father, isn't it?
Well, it is, and there may be something that's, you know, that may be the cause of his death, and it may not. I mean, it's hard to comment, isn't it? If you don't know anything about the specific case,
surely a copper's hunch is if a paramedic is lying about whether or not they injected him with anything, and then she finds, and she's got the evidence of a wrapper of a syringe there, okay. You know.
All right. Well, I mean, I've got
these nasty little deeds okay, do
well,
get done.
I mean, the wider questions that she's raising about the vaccines and so on is a bit different from the particular death of her father. They're two separate things, aren't they?
I think everyone can work that one out, Martin. Yes, of course they're two separate things, but it's a little bit ironic and tragic that her father, it looks as if, has been killed with the same drug that she's made a documentary about.
Well, that's what she's claiming. I don't know whether it's true or not. I mean, there'd have to be an investigation, and I'm not in a position to carry out such an
investigation. There has been an investigation. The police have found
nothing. Well, there you are. Nothing. They're the people who are paid to look into these things.
So nothing to see here, then?
Well, I don't know, Tony. Oh. But the general idea that they're trying to depopulate the population by using mRNA vaccines, I find that rather unbelievable, because the most mRNA-vaccinated place on the planet is Israel. They have taken four Pfizers apiece. And that means that if the deep state behind all of this wants to kill off the Israeli middle class,
there's any connection between eugenics and Big Pharma?
I didn't say there's no connection between eugenics and Big Pharma. I'm just saying that the majority of people who have been mRNA vaccinated by Pfizer or Moderna are wealthier people in the rich countries.
Well, anyway, look,
poor people have not been given. If you're going to wipe the population out, you want to wipe out the poor people, not the wealthy people, don't you? The wealthy people are the ones you want to survive if you're a eugenicist.
As we wind up, we're going to be going back actually to right near the beginning of the plandemic. This is summer of 2020 with Amazing Polly. She's done, I think, an amazing job on looking into this CRISPR technology. That is Emmanuel Charpentier, one of the Bilderbergers companies, that is enables apparently these little robots, nanobots, go into your cells, and they go snip, snip, snip on your DNA.
Many eugenicists, well, I would almost say all eugenicists, are atheists. Because they can't believe in God. They believe man needs to step in and play God and alter the human being and the human race so that it is more perfect. I mean, remember what this woman said. And if you go to the next page, is eugenics happening today? She says the most significant difference between modern genetic technologies that some view as eugenic and the historical use of eugenics is consent. That's not necessarily true, and we're going to listen to a 4-minute montage of George Church talking about the technology that he helped to invent, CRISPR, which is a gene editing suite that is available to anyone.
What is the revolution we're talking about here? We all know the revolution is CRISPR.
CRISPR. We helped invent that. January 2013 was when it was first published, but the applications are even more shocking than those papers. It can cause a deletion or an insertion or just a change of sequence with the same number of base pairs, and that's the technology that we happened to demonstrate first. We moved it from bacteria into human, a huge jump. And in January 2013.
And what I do in my lab is we take science fiction, we turn it into science fact.
When we talk about better humans, I just want to put in my brief ethical comment, which is, it doesn't mean that there is a best human. It doesn't even mean that there is a better human, except for a particular task, just like a bicycle is better than a super tanker for certain tasks.
So when we come to enhancements, when we have any new therapy, any new technology, we have watchdog organizations which are actually quite good at evaluating safety and efficacy. For example, the FDA in the United States, EMA in Europe, CFDA in China, and they evaluate that, but they do not, there are certain things they are not tasked to do typically. One of those is equitable access.
The fact is it's a multi-billion-dollar business.
They do not consider very, very long-term effects.
So you can bring in DNA from the ancient, extinct versions of these animals.
They do not consider cultural conflicts that might arise, conflicts with our accepted way of life or religion.
So basically, there's no organism on the planet that I know of that somebody's tried that doesn't work in now.
Now, what is it that we're really worried about? Sometimes people paint this really scary, nightmarish scenario of people having blonde hair and blue eyes.
And sometimes people ask me, you know, why is everybody so worked up about applying CRISPR to the germline of humans? They're not worked up particularly about applying it to the germline of animals. And plants have been genetically modified for many years now, even though some people will eat it and some people won't. The fact is there's It's a multi-billion dollar business.
This is my conflict of interest slide, and
sometimes there are delays in technology, you know, like where's my, you know, jet pack or my flying car, and other times it comes faster than we think. With CRISPR, as a way of doing genome engineering, it came out of nowhere. I mean, there was no CRISPR technology in 2000, beginning in 2013, and 3 years later, it's everywhere. It's all over the place. In fact, it's a multi-billion dollar business.
So you go back now and you look at this statement that this woman from San Diego University says, that the difference between eugenics of the past and eugenics of the present is consent. We are not giving our consent for anyone to permanently change organisms of this earth. Who's giving their consent for that? Every single person would need to consent to that, because these changes will affect every generation on down the line. And we don't know what the follow-on effects of that sort of a change is. And you heard George Church in that montage also. He said, you know, the FDA and the European regulatory bodies and the Chinese regulatory bodies are, they're good at certain things, but they don't consider long-term effects. That's not even in their purview. They're not even meant to consider that. They're not meant to consider cultural changes that might come along from any of these.
So, eugenics, I mean, this is obviously a fantastic tool for anyone that wants to design a baby's sort of thing, you know. It's a science fiction type tool, Martin, but apparently it wasn't around at all before around about 2013. Emmanuel Charpentier, I met in 2016 in Dresden, very peculiar lady, seemed quite friendly until I mentioned the word Brexit, in which case she got her security detail to come in between me and her, who I didn't even notice were there at the time. But this gene splicing technology is immensely powerful. And as Amazing Polly there says, implies that actually what we've got isn't good enough. We need to enhance it by genetically engineering humans.
Well, I mean, there are two extremes to this kind of discussion, isn't there? There's the technophobia that any technical change of any kind is to be resisted, and that we are made in the image of God, and therefore we shouldn't interfere in any way with the biology we've been given, apart from cutting off your foreskin if you're Jewish or Muslim, for example. That's a modification.
This is really, but it's nothing to do with CRISPR, which is genetic modification.
Yes, I know, all right, but I don't know enough about genetic modification. I'm worried about these kind of technologies falling into the wrong hands and being pushed in the wrong direction, obviously. The real question
is, there really any need for it? That's the question, isn't it? Is there really any need for genetically modified anything?
It depends what you mean by genetically modifying. We've modified our environment pretty,
we're not talking here about selective breeding. We're talking about going in and changing the genes using one of these little crispy engines.
I would argue that because it is such a, as you say, a potentially invasive technology, that the precautionary principle would say that you shouldn't use it unless there's a very, very, you know, unless you're sure that it's not going to have a knock-on effects. But of course there's money involved. And, you know, then they're going to do it because they want to make money out of it.
Yeah, a lot of these technologies, I mean, I'm going to hear the final clip from Mark Purdy, as I promised I'd do it before the, I think before the summer, didn't I say? Or we get it in at least the first half of the year, where he talks about what we can actually do with the technology that was introduced after World War II, the organophosphates, which are less and less used now, which he campaigned against in the 1990s. And this interview was recorded in 2000.
The first thing they can do is obviously become aware of where organophosphates are used, and particularly in relation to their diet. Buy organic if they can afford it. And that will help support producing these chemicals without using organophosphates. They can change their own lifestyles, because they might be using organophosphates unwittingly, just because they're not informed of where the chemicals are used. For instance, they're used as a flame retardant in cot mattresses, in children's nightdresses, blankets, that kind of thing. That they're also used as additives to hydraulic oil. People have had gone into paralysis syndromes as a result of handling hydraulic oil, and the recent scare was over the organophosphate additives in the oil in aircraft. So the cabins were actually filling up with very low levels of very potent organophosphate, making cabin crew chronically sick. Passengers presumably would get too small a dose to actually get ill. Yes, I mean, organophosphates are used very insidiously, you know, that they penetrated every stage of the food chain. They put on seeds, all stages of the grain crop, and even used as post-harvest treatments, where they actually put on crops to give them a longer shelf life. And I think the more aware one is of their particular range of use, then that enables you to cut them out or to write to authorities, MPs, county councils, and lobby them that these chemicals shouldn't be used, and that we're not happy with them being used. Also, they're used still as head lice shampoos for children, and councils are still writing around to parents advising them to treat with these chemical head lice dressings. And I think it's time to knock that particular avenue of organophosphate use on the head once and for all. Our only revolution is to stop supporting the use of these chemicals in from whatever direction, by not buying the products that the chemicals are being put into, by not using them ourselves. Don't subscribe to an organophosphate lifestyle in any way at all. That is the way to, you know, get these chemicals finally taken out of our food chain.
So that's the final little section in that interview I did in 2000 with Mark Purdy, bless him. Martin, his point there really is that the chemical industry in this case, pharmaceutical industry as well, in fact, all these massive mega corporations are way, way, way too powerful, and public health is suffering as a result.
Well, I think that's incontrovertible, isn't it? The you know, the use of what is essentially poisons in agriculture is clearly going to be extremely problematic, isn't it?
Well, we're just about to wind up now. Thanks very much, Martin. But we will have a little poem from Patrizia. Sorry, we're going to have two this week because we didn't have one last week. This is on the Wagner Group, To Be Yet Not to See. The Wagner Group, what a swizz, a farce played out in a tiz. Soldiers lying on the floor with guns and helmets, like at war. Seemed like a farce for all to see, from MSM or those that be. In Russia's streets, nothing had changed, all quite odd and rather strange. While busy bodies pushing war all want Putin out the door. No coup, nor was it mutiny. This may not be just what we see. The Wagner Group, a false flag who, perhaps, do what NATO asks them to. Is that possible, do you think?
I think that's the big issue. Is how far is NATO involved in this little démarche?
So a gentle pat on the back from Martin, Patrizia. But our second poem is really about Martin and I not being around last week. It's called Missing in Action. Last week, listeners' hearts in boots disarray when TG announced in his inimitable way that thisweek.org.uk, cancelled on Friday, was sorry to say. Listeners aghast were left with the blues, no intro, no music, raised voices or news. Dave, a night off from arguments and moods when Martin and Tony get stuck in a feud. Martin relentless when he is riled, a break from pal Tony, perhaps making him smile. The heat on the beat, not the BCFM news, raises blood pressure and sometimes the views. TG and MS went off air, listeners lost. Silence surround them, all counted the cost. Last Friday a space, 'twas empty on air. Listeners of TG perhaps in despair. Mr. Moody and Gruff, who cares, wrong or right, Whenever these two get into a fight, they always make up and smile at each other. Two brothers on side from two different mothers. Thanks very much, Patricia. Yes, well, we'll try and get into a few more moody fights in the coming weeks, don't worry. Anyway, I'll leave you with this, which is, I don't even know the name of the guy, but he's an Orthodox priest talking about the month of June.
Pride Month is the voice of the demons. Now, I honestly didn't know that I was going to say this when I began this sermon, but you need to know this. That those things are happening. They're happening to your children. They're happening to you. You're in your workplace, and there's all kinds of possibilities of capitulation to these demonic things in some way. And they affect us. Even if you don't give in to these things, even if you don't are not afraid to say out loud that this all this stuff is demonically sinful, as a movement, an individual person can have struggle with sin. But as a movement, this is a demonic movement meant to devour people. And that's what's happening. People are getting devoured left and right, especially with all of the trans stuff, which is completely redefining what a human being is. Human being is made in the image of God to know God. They're not defined by their gender or their sexuality or anything else. The only thing that defines you is you are made in the image of God. That's it. Nothing else. Any other definition is of the demons. And that's what's happening in this world. Now, how are you going to inoculate yourself and your children against these things? Well, you can certainly do practical things like take them out of public school, for sure. You can do practical things like teach them about things. You can do practical things like, well, not give them a phone when they're five and other stuff. But with all that practical stuff, you have to do something for your soul. And some of you didn't do it last night. You lost that opportunity. Every single time we are present in the services, there's this great grace that comes upon us. Whether we have a good time at the service or not, probably sometimes we, you know, pay attention really well. Sometimes it's hard for us, etc., etc. God is helping us, and there is this great grace that comes upon us, and it's cumulative. It's additive. And you are then inoculated against evil, against these false beliefs that are so prevalent in the world. And you gain more courage. You're going to need a lot of courage coming up. We're all going to need a lot of courage. Because the world is closing in, closing ranks, and you're going to have to basically capitulate or suffer the consequences in the world. That's going to happen. And what are you going to do about it? Well, I suppose you could get a whole bunch of, you know, shotgun shells and food and water purifiers and all those things. You can do that. I'm not against that. It's a good idea to have a store of food, etc., etc. But all those things are just temporary measures. What you need is to have a heart that is only with God, a heart that's not of stone but is of flesh. That's what you need. And your children need that too.
Sorry, I don't know the name of the guy. He's an Orthodox priest, apparently. At least he certainly looks like one, and it's on something called orthodox.net. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, our guests, Justin Thomas from the PCS Union, and also Dr. David Miller, who's fighting fund. You'll find a link to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, also to sound engineer David Bazenko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram even if you want. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full length interview, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Thanks also, of course, to RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. We'll be repeating this show on Sunday morning. Don't forget about the not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you haven't already had a go with it, install it, give it a whirl. Do please join not the BCFM Politics Show, talkradio.org.uk live stream next Friday. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down. A nation